The whole issue is designed to create a conflict which cannot be solved except by some world body. They will put two or three up there for you to vote on. All belong to them. They'll even make it like they're really against each other. They'll make you believe it. They'll even throw you some trash about one of them, so maybe you won't vote for him, thinking the election's fair because that's not a moral person. And then who do you put in the White House? Most immoral person that ever lived on this planet.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to not the BCFM politics show. Well, we were arrested from BCFM back in March this year whilst I was out in New Zealand by the BCFM managing editor, Pat Hart. And we were told it was just a brief rest. We're now told that maybe we'll be back on the air in November, but don't hold your breath. We're certainly still going online. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and also Lib Dem councillor Tim Kent for Hengrove and Whitchurch Park here in Bristol. The Christchurch mosque massacre after in the second hour. The shooter is sentenced in New Zealand, but at his trial, nothing whatsoever about evidence that he had a lot of help in the actual operation. Evidence there in the sick video he took of the killings, which was streamed live on Facebook. So is that the end of the matter? No trial, no evidence, just a sentence. And protests in the United States as Trump accepts the Republican nomination. Also, great news about polio being eliminated in Africa. But what the BBC haven't told us is that the vaccine strain of polio is still killing and maiming thousands of people who probably wouldn't have been afflicted by it if they hadn't been vaccinated. Also, 5G here in Bristol. Freya Lockwood, who works for Bristol City Council, is paid for on our behalf to lobby for 5G, says it's safe. Dr. Deborah Davis begs to differ. She's from the Environmental Health Trust, and she's talking about mobile phones and cancer. What we often hear from the 5G industry lobby is that ionising radiation is not 5G. Well, they're quite right, but that doesn't mean to say that microwave radiation doesn't cause cancer. She says it does. Former Bank of England staffer turned scholar of the central banking industry. What he saw in there, Mohamed Rafiq was interviewed on this show back in 2012, but he's passed away last week. We go back to his look at the pearls of wisdom on what's really wrong with the banking system. A Bank of England staffer who converted to Islam. And we've heard of ISIS, the medieval cult of the assassins, a neo-Islamic cult designed to discredit the faith, and also, of course, the Christian Zionists of today and history's medieval Knights Templar, the world's first international bankers, fulfilling the same role, attaching themselves to the Christian faith. But what about the Kabbalists, the Jewish so-called mysticism? Few realise that Judaism is governed by two competing books of guidance, the Talmuds, one Jerusalem Talmud and the other from Babylon. That's where the ancient Kabbalah is thought to have come from. We hear from one of the world's scholars and authors on the topic, the author of Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea, the Canadian David Livingstone. What are the true origins of the Kabbalistic Judaism? But that's in the second hour after six. First of all, joining me on the line is councillor, Lib Dem councillor for Hengrove and Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good afternoon, Tony.
Thank you for being our first councillor back after our hiatus, after having been hoofed off the airwaves and doing this show live as a live stream now. Obviously, it's obviously easy to get it on the internet afterwards and download it, etc., just as it was before. Can you just give us a brief outline of what's been going on over the last few months at the City Council? I know it's a very broad brush, but I mean, we're in a system, aren't we, where there was no election. Everyone was expecting people were starting to gear up for a mayoral election back in May, but it never happened.
Well, that's right. In fact, I've just been cleaning out some election leaflets I had all printed ready to go, and then they got cancelled. I don't think that came as a massive shock, I've got to say. I think we could see that was likely to build up. That does now mean everyone's term of office has been extended by a year. personally, I would have much preferred the elections go ahead, but I understand that there was no way we could hold them. So since then, it's been a strange affair. We have shifted to online meetings. Now, as you know, I'm normally a big critic of Bristol City Council and as in much of what it does, but I have to say that their transition to online meetings went far smoother and faster than the majority of other councils. So now you can have the joy of watching many of us on YouTube. It has opened up meetings far more to the public, as long, of course, you do have internet access. So for those who don't have that, they are currently excluded.
Okay, so in the old days, we say that, that's before March, basically. Yeah. The public had to actually come along to a meeting, but they could still see those meetings streamed live if they wanted to, couldn't they? And they could see archives of those on the council website. So I'm not so sure that... Oh, right, so, okay, so there's more stuff which is being put up online now, is there?
So now virtually all meetings are streamed live, as in where they're doing it anyway. So the general feeling is we should stream them live. Before that, maybe you saw a fifth of council meetings being streamed live. You would see the main full council meetings and cabinet meetings and an occasional other meeting. Now you will see all meetings that are public meetings should be actually put on our YouTube channel.
Okay, so the most important meetings, am I right in saying those are... Well, I mean, obviously, there's a lot of money riding on the planning meetings, but I'm just talking about for the political and how our money is spent, our taxes, you know, the council tax, the business rate, etc., how that's spent. Am I right in saying that the most important meetings are simply the cabinet meetings and the full council meetings still?
Yeah, I would say predominantly, although obviously planning has a considerable effect on expenditure in the city, if an item gets passed or not. But yes, when it comes to the city's actual finances, probably cabinet in reality is where most of the money is decided on how it's spent in the city.
How's the cabinet system working? Because it's not quite the same as when we had a Lib Dem leader, Barbara Jenk, in charge, is it?
Well, unfortunately, I think everything that was predicted as potentially being wrong with the mayoral system has proved to be true. It's proved that too much power is in the hands of too few people. It is proved that that in fact oversight is less. Strangely enough, it appears that decision making has actually slowed down, which was something which I don't think anyone had expected to happen. I'm not too sure why that's happened.
Well, can you give us? Hang on, Tim. Can you give us an example of something that's taken much longer under the mayor system?
Well, yeah, I mean, there could be loads of examples, but I guess the obvious example that will come to everyone's mind is the arena. There was the arena. The arena was ready, pretty much ready to go for a full planning application, or not far off it, just before the mayoral elections in 2012. And then what do we see happen? We see one mayor spend his term get an application through. We then see the other mayor overturn that application. So that's just one example.
Well, hang on, I'm not sure I agree with you on that, because the arena is something that John Savage at Business West, when he was at Business West and the Cultural Development Partnership, where I came across him, he was banging on about this arena right the way to the early noughties. And I suppose you could say that it didn't happen in the noughties either. That's when we had the previous system too. So the arena, I mean, it was just a slow thing, whichever system way you look at it.
Well, that's fair enough. Let's take Hartcliffe Waste Centre then. Hartcliffe Waste Centre 2012, the money was put in the budget to deliver that. Now, admittedly, then the next mayor didn't want it. The mayor we have now has promised it in his first speech to council, yet we still wait. You know, another planning application has gone in. We've been told it will open next year. You know, still yet no diggers on site. So that's over 4 years wasted, but over 8 years since we made the decision to do that. And I think you can go throughout this where there have been decisions where things have been slowed down. We could take the plan to put solar panels on all 20 odd thousand council houses across the council, all ready to go in 2011, 2012. New mayor comes in, project gets delays, government funding scheme changes, schemes then ditched. 20,000 houses that could have had solar panels on now do not have solar panels on. So I think there's lots of cases where you can say, actually, the mayoral system, because it needs the approval of one person. And in fact, one person does not have that much time in the day to do that, slows down decision making, because ultimately all decisions have to go through one person and they can't do that.
I always thought it'd be easier. Surely all Marvin Rees, the Labour mayor, has to do is just sign at the bottom of the page.
Well, in some cases, I think probably under the former mayor, Mayor Ferguson, there was a little bit more of just quickly trying to approve decisions. But I think under Marvin Rees, what we've seen is he can be quite slow in coming to a decision. I mean, if we take the arena, I mean, you sort of said that it'd been plagued with problems. That's true. He did sit on the problem for over 2 years before he did anything about it. During that period, nearly £12 million of public money was spent. And then if we take the Bristol Energy problem, I mean, everybody else in this city could see Bristol Energy was going nowhere. They could see that 18 months ago, apart from Marvin Rees.
What about what's going on in the city centre? Because we've been seeing over the last couple of months some enormous changes, trying to keep cars out of the city centre. I think a lot of people feel around the city, particularly people who run takeaways, Tim, that this is really counterproductive. It's like we're trying to turn it into really just a pedestrian city. We've also seen all these bollards going in, and this is something I've seen over the last couple of weeks, turning two-lane roads, which are always pretty much congested, into one-lane roads, making even more congestion. It does seem as if the motorist is in the crosshairs here, and the mayor is doing everything he can, really, to make the, you know, dissuade motorists from coming anywhere near the city centre now.
I think we're absolutely right to try to encourage people to shift to different forms of transport. Cities simply can't survive with the amount of motor cars that are pouring into them. And we also are aware of the issues of air pollution, of climate change. But there's a big but here. And my but is, especially coming from South Bristol, we do feel very aggrieved about some of the changes. One of the key ones for us would be the Bristol Bridge and closure of Baldwin Street. There's very, very few routes in from South Bristol into the city centre. I think there's about three. So that's one of them taken out. Now, what that means now is that more traffic will pile onto those already heavily congested roads, making them even more dangerous for cyclists, even more dangerous for pedestrians. Now, the truth is, you're always going to have to make a difficult decision here, and I accept that. And I understand the point of trying to sort of use this new norm, as people like to call it, to try to sort of speed up change. I'm all for that. But when you live out on the edges of the city, you're given very few options. Very few buses turn up. I mean, once again, I've had to submit another question to the mayor asking, where is our additional bus stop for the Bamfield and Metro bus that people were promised now 2 years ago? 2 years we've been waiting for one bus stop. That is it. I mean, that's what we wanted. We have very little in the way of access to cycle lanes and infrastructure like that. We have very, very poor bus provision on the edges of the city. So I perfectly get that those in the centre of the city want to see change accelerated. I support them in that belief. But what people need to understand is those of us on the outside of the city need to also be able to get in. And if you're going to move forward these changes, you need to also accelerate changes to public transport. And what we've seen under Marvin Rees is very little investment in public transport.
Well, that's right. I mean, the fares now, I mean, I can't believe it's £5 return to fish ponds on the bus. I mean, this is starting to get ridiculous, the fares that are being charged. And yet the mayor is patting first group, first bus on the back, saying, well, what a great job they're doing.
I believe he patted them on the back the day they increased the fares. He even boasted about the new fare deal. This was a few years ago, I remember, when in fact the fares for us out on the edges of the city were massively increased. And okay, a few people won with the fare change, but a vast majority of us on the fringes who do rely on public transport to get in and out. I mean, I try to use the bus where I can, and we want to see far more bus provision, and we also need to put in other interventions to try to reduce traffic at the city centre. We need to build park and rides, preferably smaller park and rides dotted around the edges of our city, to try to encourage people not to drive into the city and park, but, you know, to use public transport when they get into the more congested areas.
Martin Summers, you're a Labour Party member. This is a Labour mayor. For a lot of people, they're looking at for example, Bristol Bridge is the reason Bristol is here, apparently. That bridge is where the city formed around hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And now we're told, actually, vehicles are not going to be able to cross it.
Well, I'm not going to wade into all of this because I haven't got enough background information about what's being
decided. Are we just being curmudgeonly and saying we don't want change?
I think, as Tim rightly says, there's a general consensus that we want to reduce traffic in the city centre for all kinds of good reasons. Now, of course, as Tim's also rightly said, that requires difficult choices. And any change of something like this, there are going to be winners and losers.
Well, what about buses? Come on. I mean, you know, if you're going to say the cars can't come in, surely there's got to be a better bus provision.
The problem is that the mayor doesn't control what happens with buses.
We've got no tram system.
No. And indeed, in actual fact, we should have there should be a public...
In fact, you know what else we haven't got? We haven't got an underground either, which we were promised.
No, well, that's... what we really need to do is we should never have privatised the bus system in the 1980s. And so what happens is we're now picking up the pieces decades later of absolutely ridiculous policies that were imposed back in the day, and we've never changed them.
OK, well, Tim, I know you know that Tim Bowles is the Metro Mayor, and he takes quite a big role, doesn't he, in this transport policy. Has he been helping, or has he been twiddling his thumbs doing other things?
Well, I think a lot of people would question the role that Mayor Bowles does. He's definitely one of the lowest seen mayors in the country. I think he wasted time. I mean, he was given new powers under the Bus Act. He could bring in a bus strategy. In that bus strategy, he could use bus franchising to take back control, at least, of the bus network. That wouldn't mean owning the buses, but it would control where they go, how much they charge, how frequent they are. It would set up a system similar to London. Now, I think that's a lot of what people wanted to see. We wanted to see that, you know, that bold vision, that big step change in public transport. Instead, we've seen absolutely nothing. I mean, it's not just him, of course. Marvin Rees also sits on the West of England Combined Authority. He has a vote. He could have shown that leadership. We've asked him again and again and again to push this idea forward. I've got to say, an idea that was backed by the Labour Party quite often in their own manifestos for parliamentary elections. So I don't really understand why there's been such reluctance to use these new powers that we potentially have to really take control of the bus network and improve the bus network for the city.
Strange, isn't it? Anyway, I mean, the bizarre thing about Tim Bowles, of course, is that he's a Conservative mayor for a wider area, and it just seemed to me, Tim, that the whole thing was designed to make sure that there was some sort of, I mean, obviously Bristol is a generally Labour city, to extend the boundaries out into the shires outside the city, you know, sort of 10-20 miles surrounding, to take in all those Conservative rural voters so that there could be an alternative kind of competition mayor to Marvin Rees or to whoever's a Labour incumbent in Bristol. But look, you know, you've also been looking quite closely at what's been going on with Bristol Energy. I know you mentioned it just now. This was an arm's length private company that was set up, I think, actually, probably by your administration, or was it George Ferguson, Tim?
Set up by George Ferguson.
So he was the previous mayor to Marvin Rees. It all started going horribly wrong, and right at the beginning of Marvin Rees's term as mayor in 2016, he was acknowledging that there were problems with it, but nothing's been done. And what kind of bill are we now looking at, having amounts of public money having been poured into this sinkhole of a company down the drain, effectively, in order to keep it going? And where's it all heading now, do you think?
Well, my estimate is that if, say, Bristol Energy was to wind up in the next few days, which really I would have thought the mayor would want that to occur, then what we will see is a bill of somewhere in the region of about £50 million to the public purse over the whole entirety of Bristol Energy being running.
And that's taking away any profits, the modest profits that they've made over that time. Actually, I'm not sure they have ever turned a profit, have they?
They've never made a profit. To be fair to Bristol Energy, one thing it has been is very consistent. It has lost £1 million a month since launch.
Oh, my goodness. So what's happening now? Because I understand that they finally, Marvin, in his free year, before his possible re-election or maybe not re-election next May, he's decided he wants shot of this firm at last.
Following the cancellation of the elections, suddenly the mayor has now seen sense. I mean, I've got to say, a lot of us have questioned why millions and millions of pounds extra was decided to be put into Bristol Energy just before the elections were to occur. Many of us wonder whether or not that was simply to keep this company going so the truth of how much had been lost in it would not be part of the election campaign. But now the elections have been cancelled, the mayor has finally agreed that Bristol Energy should be wound up. We have sold the business element, so the business customers, the business book, has been sold to another energy company for somewhere in the region, I think it was about £1.5 million. That may sound, of course, like great news, but of course, the period that's taken to sell, we have probably lost that amount of money anyway in running Bristol Energy. They are still trying to sell the domestic customer book. That's somewhere probably just below 100,000 customers. Most of them are not in Bristol. Only 12% of Bristol's energy customers are actually in Bristol. They do need to get on and sell those because, of course, every day that ticks by, Bristol Energy racks up more losses.
It's not surprising then that over the last 3 years or so, when I've put requests in to Bristol Energy for comments and for them to put forward either their chief executive or one of their directors to be interviewed on the radio, every time, Tim, they've come back and they've either just simply not replied to my request or they've said, no, sorry, we won't be appearing.
Well, it's just unacceptable, isn't it? They're a company that is 100% publicly owned, so they are playing with council taxpayers' money, is then does not feel it's accountable to the public and the media. This is a problem, actually, we have discovered with councils running companies, is the secrecy that seems to surround these companies. I mean, secrecy has been sort of the key element, I think, of the mayoral system. Everything has become a lot more secret, but particularly around these private companies owned by the councils, they should be accountable to the public. One way for them to be accountable is through councillors, but also they should be directly accountable. And that includes, I believe, the senior management of these companies who have been paid exceptionally well and have performed well. I guess I'd say their performance is consistent. They have consistently lost money. People will have to decide, do they think the post of manager, managing director of Bristol Energy was really worth £250,000 a year.
Amazing. So £50 million down the drain. Let's move on and have a little look at the whole situation with special educational needs, because this is something where just a fraction of that amount of money would have enabled the City Council to be properly funding special needs children's education. What's been happening most recently with that, Tim?
Well, I expect a lot of your listeners are aware of the crisis that's within special educational needs. It's not completely unique to Bristol, but Bristol does now lead the local authorities as the worst performing with regards to special educational needs. And in that, one of the measures with that is the issuing of what's called education and health care plans, which is something you apply for. It replaced the old statement. They're supposed to be issued within 20 weeks. Bristol got themselves into a situation where not one single plan was being issued within the 20 weeks. And the average is now about a year it takes people to apply for these plans. Now, often when people apply for these plans, their child's life is already in crisis. Their school placement is already collapsing. There are probably significant issues at home and school.
And I'm also surprised, sorry to interrupt, Tim, but I'm also surprised that the education service is not simply doing this for the parents. Well, I mean, I'm surprised to hear that parents have got to almost like sort of go on some sort of website and go through forms, fill in various forms to apply for this. Surely, I mean, it's the responsibility of Bristol City Council to make sure children are educated to a reasonable standard.
As a parent, there's only one way to go through this process, that's to declare war. The only way you will win for your child is to declare war on the council. If you see it in any other way, you will fail. I just need to be very, very clear with people. If you're going to go down this route, it is a battle. If you treat it as a battle and you go in with that mentality, you will probably win. And that is what is wrong with the system, because, of course, that does mean middle-class parents who can access very expensive legal advice, who themselves are educated, understand the forms and understand the law, are far more successful than those parents who do not already have those advantages in life. And that's what really gets me about the system, is how unfair it is, not just on children with special needs and disabilities, but how unfair it is on families which already face those problems.
Can you give us an idea of the sorts of warlike techniques then that the City Council uses to divert parents from and their children from actually getting what they really need?
Oh, well, OK, I can give you the worst examples if you really want them. I know of at least one parent who's been accused of child abuse falsely. I know of some parents who are told that a barrister is being appointed to oppose them at the small court tribunals when they're appealing the bad decisions by the council. And the council will send in a barrister to oppose them. Often, of course, the barrister has not received the brief from the council till the minute the meeting starts. So they're a bit of a joke when it comes to the tribunal. But still, that is a common thing. They will constantly make decisions that are unlawful. They will not specify the provision that they should do. They will constantly try to undermine the professional reports and leave out key information that should be included. I'm afraid you really must go into this with the mentality of these people are not my friends, and only then can you win. It sounds terrible, and as a councillor, I feel really bad that I need to say that's how you have to, one, treat your local council and, of course, those people who work for it. But if you don't do that, you will not win. I mean, the current situation now is that there is hundreds of people stuck in a queue waiting for the EHCPs to be determined. Those are several hundred plus. The 20 weeks period, the last report said 7% were done within the 20 weeks period. But what's clear is that those have been fast-tracked. They jumped the queue. So those people in the queue are actually now waiting even longer because they fast-tracked a few applications to get them through. What is also clear is there are not enough special school places for people. So the council has just published their plan regarding special school places. It is to commit another £28 million capital money to mostly rebuild some of our special schools, but also to open some new places. That's to be welcome. But we need to be clear. It is not enough. There will not be enough special school places, nor will these special school places be delivered anywhere near in time. There's already around 190 children not able to access a special school place, even though they should be. And in the system, in that queue, are about another 250 children. So that is somewhere, that's in excess of 400 children who should currently be in special school, accessing the provision they need, and they're not.
That's pretty staggering, isn't it? Martin Summers, you're just about to probably be starting back working in schools again, aren't you, here in Bristol?
Yeah, and I often work with special needs kids. I mean, the fundamental, I think Tim would probably agree, the reason why the council is resistant to recognising these needs is because they have to find it from their own budget. There should be a national programme for looking after special needs in schools. And, of course, what you've got is...
But actually, it's more than that, isn't it? Because the council's actually doing central government's work for it. They're actively putting these people off.
Well, the point is that local councils, if they were in charge of all schools as they used to be, remember we were talking about having the local authorities running the bus service, the local authorities when I was a child used to run the schools, all of them. And therefore they mostly got their money from central government or from the rates, which of course is a property tax, which is much more equitable than the council tax. And ultimately, the council, the more people that they give recognition to the special needs of their children, they're going to have to cut but that money from somewhere else in their budget.
Martin, they don't have to employ a barrister, do they? That's surely going to cost much more than it would to actually give provision to
okay,
a child.
It may be that this whole attitude of we've got to try and keep these people at bay is wrong, fundamentally wrong, but you can see why this has been set up. I think Tim could perhaps answer me if that's the case. The council, you're a councillor, the council is doing this because they're trying to save money because they haven't got enough money, and of course they're wasting on other things.
Yeah, let's ask Tim. Tim, Martin's basically saying there that actually they're doing this because these cuts have been imposed by central government.
I mostly agree with Martin there. I mean, to be fair, the budget is set by national government, so they set the budget for special educational needs. It is nearly always overspent, and you can imagine it is, I accept, it's a difficult position that officers are in. Having said that, some of the decisions they make lead to increased costs. I also think Martin's right, by the way, that it, by removing council's oversight and planning for local school provision, has really also created a massive schism in the system, especially when it comes to special educational needs. There used to be a lot more cooperation between special schools and local schools. There used to be a lot better, I think, special school provision. And a lot of that's had to go by the wayside, partly as part of the austerity cuts, partly to do with these very poor changes to removing local government oversight and control of education, which has left nobody in charge. And that's the reality of it. Nobody now really runs education locally. I mean, we do have, of course, ironically, the council is held to account, as in it must provide the school places, but it's been removed from having the powers to open a new school to do it.
Amazing.
Maybe they should just
turn up with porter cabins or something to expand existing schools. How silly is that?
That is done in a lot. And I'm afraid a big chunk of the special school plan is about expansions, literally just turning one office into a special needs room.
I mean,
is part of the plan.
What are you talking about there with the barristers coming in, that sort of thing, you know, intimidating, various different ways of cheating and intimidating parents with special needs children? Actually, it just sounds like they're dealing with some sort of cold, faceless corporation, you know, say Shell or something like that, Tim.
I think this is why what we've seen in the city over the last few years, that the development of these special educational needs campaigners, who are predominantly mums, who predominantly are the ones, I think, who have been challenging the system. That's why when you interview them, you detect that anger. And you also detect that that feeling of justice, that basically they are on a crusade. They did not start like that. It was them encountering the system that has turned them that way.
And it's like the survivor of the fittest going on here. Those that maybe, you know, for whatever reason, their educational needs are challenged in one way or another, well, they can just fall by the wayside. That seems to be the attitude.
Well, yes, it has. But, of course, what the council have also created now are a bunch of very, very well-informed campaigners. So well-informed, they took the council to court and won. And they've made it very clear on social media in the last few days that they are planning to do the same again. They are fed up with the council having failed over the provision of special school places. They've made it clear that the council is acting unlawfully, and they've made it clear that they are now going to prepare a legal case against the council, and we'll see them back in court.
Absolutely fascinating.
So I think the council needs to act fast. It's had a chance to try to work with parents and turn this around. And every time the parents think that, you know, there's going to be a turnaround, nothing seems to happen or things get worse. And of course, we're aware that recently Bristol SEND department was inspected. So the special educational needs department was inspected by government, and it was failed. So it has to now issue a written statement of action, which is done, which is its improvement plan.
I mean, the one thing that comes out of this for me is that I would like to see our mayor standing up and talking about this more and condemning central government, etc., but we don't see that. Anyway, one of the basic things going on in Bristol is our media. Tim, would you like to just, as a ballpark figure, rate our local media out on a score of 1 to 10?
I think I could happily give them an 8 or 9. That's not brown nosing. I actually think the local media is exceptionally good. We've got guys like you, Tony, in your programme. We've got the local democracy reporters. I think they have been truly amazing at beginning to open up, particularly the council, having two dedicated reporters who report on council meetings, council business. So people sort of have an idea what the council are doing with their money. is good.
And of course, those local democracy reporters, Adam and Amanda, are both funded through the BBC budget. But as we're hearing, we're about to hear now from the former Home Affairs correspondent for Points West, Steve Brodie, there is an enormous trench of cuts coming to the BBC right now.
My name is Steve Brodie. I'm the former BBC Home Affairs correspondent here in the West Country. I was in newspapers before that, and then I worked in commercial radio, and then joined the BBC in radio as a producer, and ended up as a correspondent. The National Union of Journalists, obviously known as the NUJ, is a very old and well-established trade union. It had its heartlands in Fleet Street and went out into the regions. A very dignified trade union, and not often seen in the headlines, has a code of conduct about how to behave in a moral and proper manner, and is generally very well supported and well represented. Most journalists working in the regions, both in radio and television, are members of the NUJ. It's not a very big union, but it's very effective and has been a good watchdog over bad behaviour amongst journalists, especially in Fleet Street.
And also editors and managers.
Yes, indeed. When I was an editor in local radio, I was a member of the NUJ, and I've been a lifelong member of it. And you will frequently find people right up the management tiers being member of the NUJ.
What do the cuts or proposed cuts that the region here in Bristol mean for the people in Bristol in the West?
The effects are going to be widespread and damaging. There's no doubt about that whatsoever. For instance, the current affairs programme Inside Out West, based in Bristol with 12 or 13 people working for it, at least 50% of those have been asked to take voluntary redundancy. And it means, at the moment, Tony, throughout England and Wales, there are 11 regional Inside Out programmes. They are going to be cut from the 11 down to 6. For instance, here in the West, the programmes in Southampton and Plymouth are going to be axed. There'll be one programme, a half-an-hour programme on BBC One every week during the programme's run. That'll be based in Bristol, but there'll only be one story. At the moment, you have four or five stories per region, which, of course, is the whole idea of local journalism for local people, focusing on local problems.
So what is Inside Out West doing that the Points West and the news is not?
Well, Inside Out West, of course, is a half-an-hour programme. So therefore you can do greater in-depth journalism. That's very important. Some complex things like corruption in banking, abuse, needs to have a proper amount of time to get to the bottom of it, to give both sides, to make sure that you're giving a balanced and in-depth report. You can't do that every night on Points West, who certainly do very good programmes, but Inside Out West does longer investigations throughout our area.
What about lunchtime and evening news programmes?
Well, I'm afraid these cuts outside Inside Out West, at Points West, will mean that both technical and journalistic staff are going to be made redundant. At the moment, there's an offer out to volunteer for voluntary redundancy. That has now closed. That closed last week. It means that there will be fewer journalists. For instance, it will also mean, instead of having two presenters at 18:30, familiar faces for many years in Bristol, like David Garmston and Alex Lovell, only one of those will survive. It means there will be a change of style, and it will actually mean less stories. There will be less stories on the 18:30 programme. And that is very disappointing, and is certainly not to the benefit of the people in Bristol. Radio Bristol hasn't escaped either. One of the very oldest of local radio stations in the country. And it means their afternoon programme has gone. It's gone now. It went during the COVID pandemic, and they're not going to replace they're not going to bring it back. And it means that there will be only three programmes instead of four throughout the day. That itself is a very great shame. It cuts the voice of local people, which is what the BBC is about. It's about representing the public. And the public pay a licence fee, and they have the right for proper coverage. And these cuts certainly won't mean that.
I mean, hasn't the writing been on the wall for this for quite a long time? Inside Out West is only an occasional programme. It's been being eroded, hasn't it, for quite a long time, probably even decades.
Well, I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure about that. We are peculiarly celebrating 50 years of BBC Regional Current Affairs and local radio stations this year. Radio Bristol is 50 years old, for instance, this year. There was going to be a big party, and that's been abolished, sadly. Because I'm sure there have been some very familiar faces that could have come back for that. But the BBC has been under threat since David Cameron forced on the BBC a freeze of the licence fee. As we all know, a freeze is in fact a cut with inflation. And when David Cameron used his position to freeze the licence fee, which the BBC couldn't do anything about. I mean, the government is there to govern. And the BBC is independent of the government. People forget that. People think that the BBC should be there to produce government statements. Well, I've had 30-odd years in the BBC, and no member of the government has ever told me what to say. And that would be across the rest of the BBC. There is the argument, of course, that journalists in London get too close to members of Parliament or whatever. Well, they may do, but they still have the independence and the right to criticise. And that's absolutely fundamental, Tony, in a liberal democracy. You know, we are not living in a one-party state, although sometimes I feel possibly we are.
What about the NUJ? What's been their response? Can a union really do anything? Because the BBC have decided they're going to make these cuts.
Well, the NUJ can do quite a lot. There has been a union meeting called a chapel meeting, in which is an old printing term, in the BBC in recent weeks, a very well attended virtual meeting, of course, and a resolution was passed which calls on the BBC to stop this, absolutely to stop this. For instance, there will be fewer technical staff, fewer cameramen, fewer people working in the gallery where the programme is produced. There's absolutely no doubt that standards will go down. And there has been a very strong resolution. And I to get this right, in case make sure that anybody thinks that I'm making it all up, there was a resolution passed in which it says that the NUJ understands the BBC has financial restraints. We don't live in laissez-faire. None of us do. There are people here who are listening and watching to this interview who are either on furlough or either have already been made redundant and will not get their jobs back because of the pandemic. We mustn't forget that. But what's happened to the BBC is that we've asked the BBC, it's urged the Director General, the outgoing Director General, Tony Hall, that the ratio of managers to staff is at the moment quite ludicrous. And we have asked, the NUJ has asked, I have to say here, I'm just speaking on behalf of the NUJ, it's not me, it's the National Union of Journalists that are making these requests, to prioritise programme makers, prioritise people who go out and report on the community, that's very important, and to maintain the trust in the BBC of the public. If the BBC doesn't deliver, it will lose trust. There's no doubt about that. We're saying that these cuts will affect the BBC's position in the country. And it's a vital position, and it must be maintained. And at that union meeting, it was revealed that the 6,000 staff in the English regions, English and Wales regions, there are 6,000 staff. Of those, there are 17 senior managers who are paid between £150,000 and £327,000. And those salaries are equal to or greater than that of the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. And on top of these, there are a further 29 senior managers who could be earning anything from somewhere between £100,000 and £150,000 a year. Well, if you're spending that sort of money on these myriad layers of management, the NUJ's position is that is ridiculous and wrong, and that the money should be spent on reporting what is going on in our society.
What about members of Parliament? Is Parliament taken an interest?
Yes, they have. Both Labour and indeed Conservative MPs have written to Parliament complaining about this. After all, if you're the local MP and there's no local radio station, no BBC local station with the resources to allow you to come on and talk, you have no voice yourself. So MPs are concerned that they will lose their voice. And that's vitally important, that local people can talk through their local MPs. That is the point of having MPs. And it's interesting that broadcasters like Lenny Henry and Stephen Fry and a collection of well-known celebrities have written to the national newspapers and indeed to the BBC saying, stop this. This is a wrong decision which will have a damaging effect on how we talk to one another and how we talk to the government and people who represent us.
But they are persisting. I mean, it does seem as if there's a bit of conflict between central government and the BBC itself. Is that the case?
Yes. This is dangerous waters, of course. All governments throughout the history of the BBC since the 1920s, all governments, when they are in power, always feel that the BBC's got it wrong and don't like it. And in a way, I think that's actually right. The BBC should not be popular with governments of whatever colour. And that has certainly been the case here. Although one has to say, looking at the culture and indeed the fact that recent statements by people in power, like Dominic Cummings, who has made it, he certainly hasn't hidden his desire to destroy the BBC behind anything. He's come out and said, you know, we don't like the BBC. We'd rather there wasn't a BBC. And of course, historically, people like the Murdoch Press and indeed Associated Newspapers, publishers of the Daily Mail, have always attacked the BBC. They've attacked them for the very good reasons that they are competitors, and the BBC mostly has employed the best journalists in the country, and it is in their interests to see the BBC minimalised, perhaps, or destroyed altogether.
Well, they will say, won't they, that the commercial broadcasters like Sky can do it just as well.
Really? Is that true? Give me one story that Sky has broken in the last decade of some magnitude. You can't, because they haven't. What Sky does is very professional, absolutely, there's no question of that whatsoever. How many stories a day do they do? Tell me.
They will get their stories, as you do, from the newspapers.
I don't think so. I don't think I've ever got a story from a newspaper, actually, Tony. I do my own research, and my colleagues do, and especially at BBC Points West, where people do research themselves. People like Matthew Hill, the health correspondent, Charlotte Callum, the home affairs correspondent, people like Clinton Rogers in Somerset. The very idea that he got a story, come on, that's why we're at the BBC. We go and find stories. Dave Harvey, the business correspondent, doesn't get it out of the local newspaper, goes and finds it himself. And if he doesn't, he jolly well should. Well, correspondents, people like me when I was working there, are paid to find their own stories. That's your role. You can't just come in and say, oh, it's in the Evening Post, let's do the story. I'm not saying that reporters don't do that, but correspondents are paid to go and find their own stories, and so they should. And that is why the BBC is very successful. But looking at it globally, as it were, certainly locally, look what's happened at the Evening Post. There have been redundancies at the Evening Post. I remember coming to Bristol 30-odd years ago. The Evening Post had 50, 60 pages. It had probably had 50 journalists. There are now two correspondents on the Evening Post. one of whom is actually paid for by the BBC, because the BBC pays for local government reporters. And that's one of their two correspondents, and that is provided by the BBC. And that is a pretty astonishing thing, that the BBC, in its time of travail, is still supporting local journalists, it's still providing a job for somebody to work at the Evening Post, which I think is a very good thing.
So what are the BBC themselves saying about all this?
Well, I obviously cannot speak for the BBC. That would be entirely wrong. You must ask them yourself, Tony, what they think. But I do remember a senior manager, and I've got to get this right, obviously, because you know senior managers don't like to be misquoted, but a senior management said that the BBC's local and regional services were created 50 years ago, as I mentioned. It's the birthday, the anniversary of Radio Bristol. And she said, despite their extraordinary skills, they need significant reinvention. How do you reinvent the wheel? What's wrong with them? Why doesn't she like them as they are? Kate Adie started on BBC Radio Bristol. Didn't do too badly. Why do we need any reinvention? So I've no idea.
Just to sum up, if these cuts do go through, what mm-hmm. would it mean for viewers and listeners?
Well, Inside Out, obviously, will be unrecognisable, which is a great shame. That would be totally unrecognisable. One story a week from the whole of the southwest. Somebody living on the tip of Cornwall is not going to be interested in what's happening in Eastern and vice versa, unless it's a world-shaking story. And despite our best efforts as journalists, we don't come up with world-shaking stories every day, much as we would like to, but we don't. So therefore, people in these areas will lose their voice. They won't actually see stories about Eastern, about what's happening in Bristol Crown Court, what's happening with Avon and Somerset Police. We won't, because it won't get on. And I forgot to tell you that the new Inside Out will be edited in Birmingham. Well, please, that is not local. That is not what the BBC is about.
How about radio?
Well, there is this argument that lots of people now get their news by looking at their iPhone. And that is an argument. That the world has changed. And there's no doubt about it. There's nothing wrong with digital journalism at all. In fact, as part of these restructuring in Bristol, there will be more digital journalists. You will see more digital work. There's nothing in itself wrong with that. There's some great digital work done on the BBC online service. And if that goes, then you will struggle. You really will struggle. National newspapers are getting smaller. Most of them are now tabloids. The Guardian, the Evening Standard in London is making 150 journalists redundant, owned by a Russian oligarch, friend of Boris Johnson. The Guardian, at the other end of the scale, as it were, the other end of the political scale, perhaps, is set to make journalists redundant. It's not just the BBC. And if we're not careful, we will not have an independent and powerful organisation to take on the big players, the big corporations, people like Donald Trump. You need proper journalists to take them on. If you don't have them, we're going to be in a very sad place. And a final point, Tony, and this is probably not known by many people, but programmes like Points West, like BBC Points West, put on audience. They put on extra people watching after the BBC flagships like the 6 o'clock news and the 10 o'clock news. The bulletins after them, the audience goes up. Little known fact, and the BBC should put its hands up and say, that's what we do. But of course the BBC doesn't do that. It's one of those wonderful organisations that doesn't boast about itself. And it needs some champions, and I'm certainly one of them.
Well, that's Steve Brodie there. He's the former BBC Home Affairs correspondent, speaking to me earlier this week about the cuts, Tim. This is looking pretty grim. The local documentary series, Inside Out Points West, is going to be massively denuded, and also it's not going to be a Bristol programme anymore. It's going to be a Birmingham show.
Well, I think a lot of people would say that they would want to see even more local news over there, BBC, even more locally based, not put into these super regions. I think the work that we see come out of the local BBC programme so far has always been exceptional. I've always been truly amazed at the work ethic of the journalists, their fairness, they're willing to challenge and stand up to the powers that be to help uncover where things are wrong and to champion where things are great. And I do worry that the BBC are making the wrong decision. And I think actually it was an interesting point there about the big salaries. I'm afraid we see this in local government as well, the constant expansion of big salaries. We've seen this at Bristol over the last several years. There are now far more people and bigger salaries.
If you do those that crunch the numbers for these 46 very highly paid senior managers in BBC nations and regions, instead of those 46 people who never appear on air, for example, they're not doing any kind of actual production work or whatever. So, you know, if they were to go on holiday for a year, very unlikely that anyone would even notice. That would be the equivalent of something like 400 full-time jobs.
I imagine it would be, because the other thing we all know is journalism is not a very well-paid profession. So the reality is a lot of the people who are out there doing the hard work are doing it not at great pay. And that's particularly the case for, you know, in the newspaper industry, for people like the Post journalists and all work on considerably lower salaries than really what they should be entitled to.
Just chatting to Steve, he was saying that one of the consultants is a full-time person working for Nations and Regions, who's on around about £150,000. They actually did a Freedom of Information request to the BBC, the NUJ did, and they found out that this chap was doing event coordination. And, of course, he's been being paid full-time for doing absolutely nothing because there haven't been any events.
It's all right for those that can get it, isn't it? But that's not what our public services are there for. And although the BBC are a sort of independent public service, they are a public service. And I think, to be honest, a lot of the public are now getting fed up of what they see as excessive wages for managers at the top, who often actually are not that specialist in what they're doing. And we want to see far more emphasis on that money being put back into the front line. Journalists and services. I am quite worried about some of what I heard there. It was actually a lot more detail than I had than I knew before from that interview. I hadn't fully realised how deep the cuts were going to go. And I think maybe this should be something that Bristol City Council should be debating. But of course, as we know, our current mayor prefers to attack local journalists rather than support them.
Well, that's a great pity. Martin, what do you make of this attack on the BBC? Because this is by central government, not by Marvin Rees as the mayor, as Tim was just hinting there. The government really seems to be saying that, well, we've had enough of this. We're going to freeze the licence fee. We don't like the idea of public service broadcasting at all.
I think Dominic Cummings would totally agree with you 100%.
And why? Why is it?
Because it's an alternative voice. What they want is a commercial setup. Commercial everything, and that's why the salaries are so big. They're equivalent to the salaries of people working in the private sector at that sort of level, and they want the public services to be made user friendly to the commercial sector, and ultimately, of course, get rid of public service sector. In the United States of America, you don't have anything like the BBC. You've got the PBS, but it's a minor thing, and basically everything's
commercial.
Well,
you do. You have, there's this thing called C-SPAN, which is similar.
It's not the same thing, is it?
What the BBC do, and as Steve was pointing out there, is they're actively going out sourcing stories all the time, which is actually quite a time-consuming and expensive operation.
Well, it is, and of course, what it leads to is when it's working properly, is they expose all sorts of things that Conservative and other governments don't want to talk about.
I wonder, both you, Tim, and you, Martin, hasn't the BBC kind of had it really? Because every single government that comes along, its independence demands that it opposes that government and it challenges that government. And the government itself is now in a sort of Peter Mandelson type situation. I remember working at the BBC in London. We used to joke about Peter Mandelson. He was the Labour peer he actually was a Labour MP at the time, would phone up editors and say, I'm going to get you, or if he'd phone up journalists and say, look, if you don't lay off, I'm going to get you sacked because I know your editor. This seems to be happening more and more. We've also seen during the pandemic, the afternoon programme on Radio Bristol being cut due to the pandemic, but them not being restored. On the BBC World Service, we've seen World Update, one of the best programmes on the World Service, with Dan Damon, a daily review of the world's news for an hour in the mornings, at least in the UK, GMT mornings, that being axed due to the pandemic and then never being put back again. And of course, we've had the same sort of experience with Bristol Community Radio, even little tiny Bristol Community Radio using the pandemic as a reason to get rid of us and then not restoring the show. So it does seem as if there are moves, doesn't it, Tim, to actually moves on independent journalism, not just in the city, but in the wider world.
Well, I think the greater threat to the BBC is probably the streaming services. And the thing the BBC have got that can fight back against that is their journalism, is their news, is their public service broadcasting. And of course, if that is undermined, you're quite right, then their whole purpose is dug away at, is undermined, and then it's easier for the government to get rid of them. I personally think it would be a very, very brave government to try to scrap the BBC. I think the vast majority of the public want to keep the BBC as is. And I personally think the BBC are making the wrong decision on cutting regional programmes.
Yeah, well, there's
I realise they want to put more into the digital world, but I think, you know, there's other places they need to look. And I think they need to consider what is their core purpose and concentrate on that. And part of that core purpose is its local news broadcasting and local public service shows. And that's where I think they should be putting their money and not trying to necessarily compete with the big streaming services. Mm-hmm. I think that is a recipe for disaster.
Well, there's an enormous difference between the regional BBC, which we are talking about here, Steve Brodie's Points West BBC West correspondent, and the national BBC. Certainly, I don't think the national BBC is anywhere near as popular as regional. And in fact, as he was pointing out there, Martin, he's saying what they do every evening, every weekday evening. In fact, it's weekends too, isn't it? They have a national bulletin at 6 p.m. and then there's a regional bulletin that comes just after it. He's saying that the regional bulletin is actually picking up audience. So people are not interested in hearing the BBC London news. They're much more interested in hearing what the White Ladies Road here in Bristol is producing every evening.
Well, that's obviously a unique selling proposition, isn't it? Very different from, you know, you can get main news from any outlet, but the local news is local. And, of course, you mentioned the World Service there. That's actually funded by the Foreign Office. And you could argue, and if I was Vladimir Putin, I might, that therefore it's basically British government propaganda at the taxpayers' expense. I don't think it is, but it's funny, isn't it, that when other countries have their national broadcasters, like RT and so on, that's regarded as some kind of terrible thing.
Well,
but when we do it, that's okay.
Well, look, if George Orwell was sitting around this table with us, Martin, he probably would say it is British propaganda, actually, the World Service, especially since we now hear lots more American programmes, American correspondents, so-called BBC correspondents, American interviewees. It almost seems like it's just an outpost of Washington, the World Service now.
Well, indeed. Well, the case I'm making is that you've got to recognise that everything has to be funded by somebody, and what you really want is editorial independence. I mean, that's the key to everything, isn't
okay,
it?
Okay, well, anyway, look, just a couple more stories to go. We'll squeeze them in into this slightly extended hour. Sorry, folks. So it's the other thing of this week we must discuss is this whole business of the BBC banning the singing of Land of Hope and Glory. Before we hear from the former Director General, Michael Grade, who also was the boss of Channel 4 for a long time, what do you make of this, Tim? Is this a bit of political correctness gone too far? They're saying that, next year people will be allowed to sing Land of Hope and Glory or Rule Britannia.
Well, it was my understanding that a decision was made regarding COVID. It was nothing to do with the song, but it was to do with singing. And
okay,
the
do you believe that? Do you believe
infection.
That? Do you believe that?
Yes, I probably do believe that. I believe that certain right-wing politicians have grabbed hold of this story and have spread it to try to detract from their utter uselessness at leading this country.
Okay, Martin, what do you make of... are you there singing Royal Britannia at the last night of every proms?
Well, I think I'd rather... I tend to agree with what Tim said. I mean, it's been turned into a confected thing with Piers Morgan on the Sky or wherever it is going on about that they're trying to get rid of Land of Hope and Glory, etc.
Well, it's not been turned into anything, has it? Because it's a tradition that's been going on since Henry Wood started.
No, I know, but I mean, the point, as Tim Peng, the reason they're not having singing is because you can't have singing in churches. Yeah?
Is that right?
Well, in COVID, because it's a COVID measure. But what's happened is it's been picked up by the right-wing press and by politicians because they want to have a culture war about it. I don't care.
Surely it's also been picked up by people who enjoy the last night of the proms.
Well, in actual fact, I listen to the proms a lot, and in actual fact, the last night of the proms, the people who turn up for that are the people who are actually not that interested in music. But that's another story. Well, people are allowed to sing whatever they like. And of course, this is basically a confected. Next year, they're all going to be belting it out as
Tim,
before.
Tim,
and the question is still going to be whether going to be allowed to do it.
I am instinctively opposed to nationalism. Broad brush. I mean, that kind of my country's better than your country position, I'm wary of. But I am not against love of country. Mm. I am very much a lover of country. And I am patriotic in that sense. And my patriotism extends to the whole of the British Isles. I consider myself British. And I love the whole place. I say this over and over again, and I won't back down from it. The welcome that I've had in England, Ireland, Scotland and Wales has always been... And I love the place, and the work that I've done, the books I've written, the television programmes I've taken part in, I think have been celebratory, where possible, and always alive weight to the idea that history is a story, a long story of light and shade, and you discuss the good and the bad, and you move forward constantly. But underlying it all for me is love of country, and this thing about Rule Britannia and Land of Hope and Glory, I think especially at the moment when people are under so much pressure emotionally and economically with everything that's been going on with the lockdown and all of the sort of internecine trouble that's been there. And people have lost a great deal. Some people have lost loved ones. Certainly lots of people have lost liberties and they're looking at an uncertain future and losing jobs and all the rest of it. And to take away more from people and to contemplate taking away singing, I don't believe many people, if any people, sing... Join in with Land of Hope and Glory because they're wanting to celebrate slavery or that kind of angry triumphalism. Mm. It's a rattling good tune and it's great choruses for both songs. And when you I used to watch it. I've never been in the Royal Albert Hall, but I've watched the last night of the proms often and just smiled. I don't think you can. If you're open-hearted, I don't think you can do but smile when you see people of all ages and from all backgrounds just singing their lungs out.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, singing is an expression of joy. And if there's one thing that we need as much as possible at the moment, it's for opportunities for people to come together joyously. And for most, for the vast majority of people who would sing that song in that place and time, they're just wanting to express joy and to contemplate taking that away. And I think if as a person, when you look on at the world and if you look on at individuals and all you see is ugliness and evil and darkness, then you have to remember that that's you.
Mm.
You are projecting onto the world around you the darkness in your own heart. And if you think that people are only singing songs and only doing things because of an ugliness inside, then it's your own ugliness that you're projecting onto the world there. And just leave people in troubled times to find a bit of joy where they can.
Tim, is Royal Britannia racist? What do you think?
I don't think it's racist. I think that the thing is, with any song of its day, it obviously puts forward the views of the people of that point. It is obviously very jingoistic. It is very much about how great Britain is. And on occasion, do you know what? That is not a problem. I don't think we want to be constantly policing ourselves and leave ourselves with zero fun. I think what we do need to do is sing a lot more Trelawney and Cornish songs there. I think that would be great.
So
there's a great line in Trelawney about how the Cornish are killing the English, by the way.
Yes, that's
I think that should be banned.
It's like the Irish national anthem, the soldiers' song. They changed it for what's it called? The one they sing now.
You can think about that, Martin. I'm trying to remember it. Whilst I just remind people of the absolutely hilarious first lines of Land and Hope, Land of Hope and Glory. I know it's Royal Britannia, isn't it? Is Royal Britannia? Britannia rules the waves. Britons never, never, never shall be slaves. Well, obviously, Britannia does not rule the waves, and so there's got to be a little bit of a smile people sing it when people are singing that. I suppose they're hearkening back to the days of empire, and actually, ruling the waves really meant going round and bombing and destroying using your naval cannons any of your enemies, didn't it?
Gunboat diplomacy.
I'll put the lyrics up actually, I think, on our show page, because just reading through them, they definitely don't seem to be negative. They seem to say things like, well, where the British Empire goes, commerce is good, and that sort of thing.
I think one of the things that people have picked up on, and Britons never shall be slaves, that was written in the 1740s. And, of course, the slave trade was going great guns at that stage. And, therefore, Britons, i.e. white people from Britain, are never going to be slaves. But our ships are quite happily taking slaves across Atlantic as we sink.
Didn't Britain actually play quite an important role in ending the slave trade? There were many other European nations that were doing the slave trade at the time, weren't
there? Yeah, well, they did. But don't forget, we were the ones who pioneered it. And that certainly in the 1740s, when that song was written, it was basically the case that, Britain was still the major slaving country. And, of course, a lot of it is actually directed at the Scots, because, of course, in the 1740s, they were just about to rebel.
It's obviously a bit of hypocrisy in this Royal Britannia, but definitely.
That line could also hark back to the period before that. Admittedly, it is before that. It's more in the 17th century, but it was not uncommon then for people, certainly on the Cornish and southern coast, to be kidnapped by pirates. Yeah. It happened a lot in the late
Barbary
17th
pirates,
century.
Yeah.
And then someone would be sent off to buy them back. Quite often they would get them back because they would be held for ransom more than anything. But Britain had completely lost control of the waves, ironically, in the late 1600s. Yeah. And that was the turnaround, I think, actually, it was sort of. And so there may be a little bit of that going on. You know, we now rule the waves and we won't be your slaves is perhaps what they're trying to scream.
Well,
out.
Nowadays, the United States, I don't know if they rule the waves. They certainly rule the air. US B-52 bombers are back in Britain, escalating nuclear tension, according to the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament this week. Six US Air Force B-52 bombers arrived at RAF Fairford on Saturday. Official sources describe it as a long-planned training mission carrying out theatre and flight training across Europe and Africa. But local news site Gloucestershire Live describes it as a surprise deployment. The much-respected expert Hans Christensen from the Federation of American Scientists posted a picture of six bombers on Twitter describing it as a pointed message to Russia. He went on to note the interesting timing of the deployment given what's happening in Belarus, observing that these exercises normally take place over Poland and the Baltic states, who are Belarus's neighbours. So there are certainly some people pointing to this, Martin, as a geostrategic move, bringing these B-52s over to Gloucestershire by the Americans.
Well, the idea that we're going to have a nuclear war over political disputes in Belarus is rather alarming.
But these can carry conventional weapons too, can't they?
Well, even a conventional war. I mean, basically, do we need to have American bases here dragging us into conflicts with other people? I would be with the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament on this. Maybe we should just be like Switzerland and mind our own business, eh?
Or maybe like New Zealand and just say, we're not having anything here that might be nuclear. The Americans then say, mm-hmm. we're not going to tell you whether it's nuclear or not. So the New Zealanders then say, well, you're not having anything here then. In fact, I was chatting to someone over there, Tim, when I was over there earlier this year, and they were saying, well, when the United States aircraft come to air displays in New Zealand, they're not allowed to land. So they have to come from some Pacific island, fly over to New Zealand, fly around, and then fly off again, because the Americans refuse to say what does and doesn't carry nuclear weapons. Anyway, what do you make of this arrival of these B-52s in Gloucestershire?
Now, normally, Tony, I don't normally buy into your conspiracy theories, and I've got to say I'm probably not going to buy into this. I think sometimes we put a little bit too much faith into the competence of our superpowers. I don't think there's any way they'd be able to organise 6 B-52 bombers over here within a week of Belarus being in crisis. I also think that actually Donald Trump does not give two hoots about Belarus and probably would not be able to find it on a map in a month of Sundays. I also agree that there's no way we would go to war over Belarus. I do feel that we should do what we can within reason to support the people of Belarus to demand legitimate, open, free government. And of course, as we know, that's not what Mr. Putin wants in Belarus. But I think very clearly Belarus is in the Russian circle, and anyone in the West is treading very, very carefully when it comes to Belarus. So I suspect it is, as said, it was a long-standing training mission. If they'd had any sense, they would have cancelled it, knowing the timing. But they don't have any sense, and that's why it went ahead.
Well, Councillor Tim Kent, Lib Dem for Whitchurch Park, thanks very much for joining us on the first hour of the Not the BCFM Politics Show. We're going to finish, though, with Just Martin to comment on this. And this is Michael Grade, Sir Michael Grade, in fact, who's a former chairman. He wasn't the chairman of the BBC. He was the director general, who is the editorial chief of the BBC. And his comment on the pulling of Royal Britannia and similar songs from the last night of the proms.
It demonstrates really how out of touch they are with their core audience. Anything more designed to upset the core BBC fans, the people who love the proms, than coming up with this ridiculous idea of not singing the lyrics to Rule Britannia is just beggar's belief. It's just idiotic, really. I don't think there's any plausible explanation for dropping the lyrics. It's just too woke to be believable, frankly. It's classic BBC talking to itself and not understanding the public mood and public attitudes.
Michael Grade says it's implausible.
Well, as I understand it, nobody's allowed to sing, not in churches, not at the
la, 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 la.
Yes, well, in there we are. Well, you're singing now, but the question is, this is being whipped up by those, like the kind of people who thought that when we tipped Colston's statue into the river, we wanted to tear down the cenotaph. You've got people who are making a big deal out of this. I was going to mention earlier.
Who said that?
Well,
the far right might have done.
The far right, that's exactly what the far right is saying. I'm not opposed to people singing Rule Britannia and...
But you seem to be implying that people that sing Rule Britannia are from the far right.
No, they could be. I mean, Britain First have a logo with Rule Britannia on the bottom of it. So they certainly sing it, but that doesn't mean that everybody who sings it is a fascist.
Oh, well, I'm glad about that. It's nice to hear that opinion from you, Martin. Anyway, so we are going to be back in a minute. That was Tim Kent from the Bristol Lib Dems and Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. We'll be back after some music.
Oh, no!
The Democrat proposed bill HR 6666.
That means the full power and strength of the military.
I'm just an average man with an average life. Put on my mask to drive. Hell, I'm just being nice. They won't leave me alone, even in my safe space home. Voice at my door says, you're in the COVID zone and we'll contact tracing. not very neighborly. I watch the news at night and lock my door with fright. People in a van I'm trying to avoid. Am I under surveillance or am I just paranoid? In the parking lot frightened, I'm afraid to go in there. They might interrogate me or want samples of my hair. Apps that are tracking me installed on my phone. Vaccinate and chip me and send me back home. That's why I just don't want them injecting me. Psychotic pharmacy, oh no. I won't comply with Nancy Pelosi. Total hypocrisy.
Officials may be using so-called contact tracing to affect the outcome of this year's election.
Oh
no! It's
only contact tracing
to
stalk citizens,
track
down people,
search their homes. It is for the public good.
Some people have expressed privacy concerns tied to the data collected. Health officials say it's necessary.
They think we're invading their privacy, which in this case we do.
That tower microwaving me. There's a chip in me. They subpoenaed my ISP. The CDC. Operation Warp Speed makes no sense to me. Unsafe technology. Not in my country. No police state for me. My choice, my body. Bill Gates and Soros. They want technology. Nightmare for you and me. The contact tracers, they're coming down the street. Just don't come visit me. The contact tracers, they're apprehending me. Throw me in quarantine. The contact tracers, now they're injecting me. No herd immunity.
We need more contact tracers than before.
So that's Media Bear. Seems to be producing quite a lot of interesting tunes over in the US. Welcome back to BCFM's politics show. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. This week, the Christchurch mosque massacre shooter sentenced in New Zealand, but at his trial, nothing whatever about evidence that he had a lot of help in the operation. Evidence there in the sick video that he took of the killing streamed live on Facebook. So, is this the end of the matter? Protests in the US also, and Trump accepting the Republican nomination. We'll be hearing from Trump in a minute, as we did from Biden last week. And great news about the polio being eliminated in Africa. But what the BBC didn't tell you is the vaccine strain of polio is killing and maiming thousands of people who probably wouldn't have been afflicted if they hadn't been vaccinated. Also on 5G here in Bristol, we heard protests last week about a 5G mast going up in St. Paul's. Freya Lockwood is employed by Bristol City Council as a lobbyist for 5G in the city as part of Bristol Smart Cities. She used to work at a company called Kinetic, which is a privatised version of the research arm of the British military. Freya Lockwood, what are you doing exactly? She doesn't respond to any of my requests for interviews, even though she's a public servant, supposedly. Anyway, she says it's all safe, this 5G. Is she lying? Dr. Deborah Davis from the Environmental Health Trust will be hearing from her, talking about how mobile phones definitely do cause cancer. And a former Bank of England staffer turned scholar of the central banking cult by what he saw inside the Bank of England. His name is Mohammed Rafiq. I interviewed him for this show back in 2012, but he's passed away last week. We go back to look at his pearls of wisdom and what's really wrong with the banking system from an insider, a former insider. And we've heard of ISIS and the medieval cult of the assassins, a neo-Islamic satanic cult designed to discredit the faith, and the Christian Zionists and history's medieval Knights Templar, the world's first international bankers fulfilling the same sort of role, attaching themselves to the Christian faith. But what about the Kabbalists, the Jewish so-called mysticism? For you realise that Judaism is governed by two competing books of guidance, the Talmuds, one Jerusalem Talmud and the other a Babylonian Talmud, and and that's where the ancient Kabbalah is thought to come from, the second of the two. We hear from one of the world's scholars and authors on the topic, the author of Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea. His name is David Livingston, the guy that we always seem to have problems with WhatsApp, Facebook and Skype when we're trying to interview him. And so we ask him, and I hear from him today, what are the true origins of the Kabbalistic Judaism, what many people call a fake version of the faith? But Martin, first of all, we hear this week great news that Donald Trump has accepted the nomination for president. Is this really theatre, this election race? And can Trump possibly lose against Biden?
Well, it's it could go either way. I mean, if you look at the opinion polls, either of them could win.
But Biden is not really a great personality in front of the camera. He's extremely elderly, and apparently he can't really function at all without an auto cue to read from.
Well, that's why he's chosen Kamala Harris to run the country if he wins. And Trump's got lots of solid supporters who are going to vote for him whatever he does. He assassinated Soleimani at the beginning of the year, which nearly turned into World War III. Luckily it didn't, but it might have done, and people might decide, but actually we can't afford another 4 years of Trump. So Biden, it has to be, because the first-past-the-post system, as rubbish in the United States as it is here, means that third parties can't get a look in. So it's one or t'other, and that's what they're left with.
Okay, so anyway, let's have a listen now, as we did last week, to Biden, to a bit of Donald Trump and his acceptance speech for the Republican nomination for November's US presidential elections to run the... Actually, no, before we hear that, Martin, does the president really run the Anglo-Zionist empire?
No, as Putin pointed out years ago, I've spoken to four different presidents, and it's quite clear that they don't make the policy.
Biden voted for the NAFTA disaster, the single worst trade deal ever enacted. He supported China's entry into the World Trade Organization, one of the greatest economic disasters of all time. After those Biden calamities, the United States lost 1 in 4 manufacturing jobs. We laid off workers in Michigan, Ohio, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, and many other states. They didn't want to hear Biden's hollow words of empathy. They wanted their jobs back. As vice president, he supported the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which would have been a death sentence for the U.S. auto industry. He backed the horrendous South Korea trade deal, which took many jobs from our country and which I've reversed and made a great deal for our country. He repeatedly supported mass amnesty for illegal immigrants. He voted for the Iraq War. He opposed the mission to take out Osama bin Laden. He opposed killing Soleimani. He oversaw the rise of ISIS and cheered the rise of China as a positive development for America and the world, some positive development. That's why China supports Joe Biden and desperately wants him to win. I can tell you that. Upon very good information, China would own our country if Joe Biden got elected. Unlike Biden, I will hold them fully accountable for the tragedy that they caused all over the world. They caused. In recent months, our nation and the world has been hit by the once-in-a-century pandemic that China allowed to spread around the globe. They could have stopped it, but they allowed it to come out. We are grateful to be joined tonight by several of our incredible nurses and first responders. Please stand and accept our profound thanks and gratitude.
I suppose that's a great way to end your presidential speech, Martin, isn't it? Talking about how the first responders... but he's doing everything he possibly can to pin up Biden as basically he's working for the Chinese.
Yeah, Biden basically is in the pocket of Wall Street, and so is Donald Trump. And they're both claiming that the other side is in the pocket of the Chinese, which is pretty ridiculous. in the circumstances. The Wall Street has allowed Trump talking there about losing jobs to China. During his presidency, they've lost more jobs than ever to China. So all this stuff about how it's basically to do with what's called the Triffin dilemma. If you're going to have a world currency as your currency is the world's reserve currency, you've got to have trade deficits. It's just economically logical. And if you don't want to have trade deficits, then you've got to stop the dollar being the world's reserve currency, which means that you've got to end the American empire, which means you've got to bring all your bases back. I mean, a lot of the trade deficit in the US is they spend all the money having 180 bases around the world. If they brought them all home, then they'd have a lot more money to spend at home. But unfortunately, they don't want to do that. And of course, that's going to carry on whoever the president is, because that Triffin dilemma hasn't gone away, and it won't go away until Wall Street collapses and the US is defeated.
I mean, looking at antiwar.com this week, the headlines at the moment, looking at particularly at tensions with China, which Trump seems to be pushing, Biden the opposite. They're saying both Taiwan is extremely nervous. The Philippines are saying if China attacks our Navy, we'll call the US. Pompeo, the Secretary of State, is moaning about China fishing near the Galapagos Islands. He's saying it's deeply troubling. It does seem as if this is all... China is a long way from the United States, and actually what's going to happen if they relations do collapse between the two, as they're beginning to do, particularly as Pompeo seems to want them to do, is countries like Taiwan and the Philippines are going to be the ones in the crosshairs.
They are, yeah. And, of course... the Chinese see these things rather differently. I mean, a lot of this stuff is their neighbourhood. I mean, if the Chinese Navy was carrying out exercises off the coast of Los Angeles the way that the Americans seem to want to do off the coast of China, then Trump would have something to complain about. But, of course, they're not, and they don't. And, in fact, the only way forward for everybody is to cooperate to try and prevent World War III. And, of course, this kind of political rhetoric in the United States, and both sides are doing it. Biden's claiming that Trump's soft on China. You know, there's no common sense there. I mean, the only thing that will make them understand that they can't talk like that is if the Chinese sink a couple of their aircraft carriers and say, what are you going to do about it?
Well, of course, I know what they'd do about it, is they would sink there would be potentially a third world war would start, Martin.
Because you wouldn't...
You're saying that's the only option?
No, I'm just saying that this kind of political rhetoric in the US... The Chinese roll their eyes. Yeah? They've forgotten about the Korean War, where they were fought to a standstill.
I mean, it does seem that they take a mature attitude in trying to take a step back from all of this, mm-hmm. and allowing the Americans basically to make blunders. I mean, we've seen over the last week, haven't we, with the visit of the chief of the International Atomic Energy Authority to Tehran. They've agreed apparently a couple of inspections of sites, nuclear inspections. There's also the attempt by Pompeo, a rather cack-handed one, ham-fisted attempt, in order to try and invoke certain clauses in the joint JCPOA, we mentioned that last week, which were completely, you know, they're not even in this the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. They left it 2 or 3 years ago, and yet they're still trying to invoke clauses from a deal they're not even in.
Yeah, they're not signatories to the law of the sea either, but they're trying to enforce it in the South China Sea, even though they won't sign up to it themselves. They're not members of the International Criminal Court because they don't want their generals to stand trial.
There's definitely a lawless streak in the US, isn't there? They're not interested in international law, really, are they?
Well, they are, as long as they're the ones making the laws and everybody else has got to obey them. And, of course, that's regarded as normal in US politics, sadly. Anybody who talks any common sense about it is shouted down as not being sufficiently pro-American enough. But, of course, the rest of the planet has to put up with their arrogant behaviour, frankly. And we don't get any vote in this at all. But they decide what's going to happen, and the rest of us have to suck it up.
And also, they get to land their B-52s down the road from here whenever they feel like it.
Well, indeed. And as I said before...
And making us, maybe, by the way, making Gloucestershire a target for a potential nuclear attack.
And that's why they're not allowed to do it in France, and they're not allowed to do it in other in Switzerland, for example. Why is Britain just allowing the US to use our land in that way? And that's because we've always done it.
It's the unsinkable aircraft carrier.
Well, indeed. But, I mean, but ultimately, they're reaching a point now where the Germans, for example, are defying them to build the Nord Stream 2 pipeline with the Russians. And ultimately, the Americans should go home. They don't. There's no reason for them to Europe at all.
You know, when these B-52s arrive, I'm reminded of Duncan Campbell's work. He was an investigative journalist and mainly working in the 1980s. He did the Secret Society series for the BBC under Alistair Milne, which was one of the things that annoyed the Thatcher government so much that they completely, they put John Burt in charge of the BBC, got rid of the Director General. Certainly as important work was his, but he did a book called The Unsinkable Aircraft Carrier in the 80s, all about American military power in Britain. But he also did one which was in a way more disturbing, which was called War Plan UK, which was basically a NATO plan saying that if there was any kind of, you know, serious war, like a, you know, international conflict, that much of the UK regional command centres, etc., would be taken over by US military here in Britain, just deciding you're going to move this way and basically telling our military what to do.
Yeah, well, the same is true in Germany, of
course. And our population.
The same is true in Germany. And, of course, Trump is threatening the Germans that he's going to take his troops out of Germany. And quite a lot of people on the left in Germany are saying, well, good riddance, go away. The Poles are then saying, well, bring them here, we want them. The right-wing government in Poland are actually promising that they will pay taxes to have the US based in Poland. All of which is to do with people's perceived threat from Russia, etc. I think the situation is actually incredibly fragile. And election campaigns where people are banging the drum like Trump for confrontation are really not helpful.
Well, I can tell you what, Pompeo has definitely been banging his drum for confrontation over in the Gulf states this week. He's been all around trying to recruit them, like the United Arab Emirates was last week, into signing deals with the Israelis. Now, of course, we know the background to this, Martin, is that these Gulf states have been working very closely with Israel for many, many years. It's just a question of whether they would like to say that publicly, because their own population in those countries might not be too happy about that.
Not that that matters, because they're not democratic countries.
Well, I mean, it does. If you're not necessarily in a stable position as a ruler, then you might find that your population may even revolt against you, you know, in some way. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a big difference, isn't it, between doing these deals with the Israelis secretly behind closed doors and saying, actually, it's our good old Israeli brothers. A lot of people, particularly Muslims in those countries, would be not necessarily happy with that.
Well, I think you'll see that Mohammed bin Salman was supposed to meet with Netanyahu in the US this week, but he's bottled it.
He pulled out.
For the kind of reasons you've just suggested.
In the Middle East Eye this week, Pompeo ends his Middle East tour without a single state agreeing to normalisation with Israel. Bahrain, Oman and Sudan all failed to follow the UAE's lead in normalising ties with Israel. US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo headed home yesterday, marking the end of a Middle East tour, which was effectively, Martin, a total failure.
Yeah, but of course what's going on is that the Iranians have said this week that the attack on Natanz and various other things was definitely sabotage. So that's definitely the Israelis and the Americans, presumably with British support, attacking things inside Iran. You see, the Iranians might turn around and say, hang on a minute, you're supporting blowing up our stuff. Maybe we ought to come to your country and blow up some of your stuff. And then we can have a negotiation, can't we, on the basis of equality. And, of course, we've got the bomb in Beirut, which senior people in Lebanon have already hinted, and Trump himself hinted, was a bomb attack. And that bomb attack that killed hundreds of people wasn't carried out by Hezbollah, wasn't carried out by the Russians, wasn't carried out by the Chinese. It's probably carried out by the Israelis, those friends of humanity.
Unfortunately, a lot of this information you're not going to get on the World Service, you're not going to get on BCFM, you're not going to get on Radio Bristol, but you will get it here. I mean, let's just have a little bit more closely look at this deal between the UAE and Israel. This Middle East Eye article explains, just 1 week after the announcement of the UAE-Israel deal, Israel has strongly objected to the Americans' plans to sell US F-35 stealth fighters to the Emirates, resulting in the UAE cancelling a meeting that was set to take place in Abu Dhabi with Israeli officials. So it's already, you know, coming off the boil, that particular pot. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu denied reports the UAE deal hinged on the F-35 sale, but says he opposes any move that could reduce Israel's strategic military edge in the region. Speaking to Agence France France Presse. Lovett said that it is possible that a lack of clarity on the US commitment to deliver F-35s to the UAE could also played a part in slowing a second wave of normalisation amongst other Gulf states and also Sudan. So this is a really interesting side to all of this, isn't it? This is what this deal is really about. It's nothing to do with normalising relations with Israel. The UAE, the Emiratis, just want these F-35s. And the Americans said, if you want them, you've got to go sign this deal, Israel deal.
Well, that may well be so, Tony. Of course, the underlying all of this is the hostility of the Sunni monarchies, dictatorships, and the Israeli dictatorship, which is effectively what it is from a Palestinian point of view, their hostility to Iran. And that overwhelms any kind of hostility.
But surely the Israelis would be wise to say, well, yes, actually, let's not object to the Emiratis and the other Gulf states having these F-35 jets, because that would actually mean that more of these Gulf states would be openly supporting Israel and against Iran.
Well, the danger is, of course, that there might be revolutions in those countries, as happened in Iran in 1979, and then the revolutionaries would have access to the F-35 jets and so on, as the Iranians captured all of the US materiel that the Iranian army had been armed with in the 1970s. The situation is very, very tense. The Iranians are waiting to see who wins the election in November. They're not going to go to war yet, because they're hoping that Biden probably would be let more biddable than Trump, because Trump's definitely in the pocket of the Israelis. Although Kamala Harris made a speech yesterday saying that her support for Israel was unconditional, which is frankly absurd, but there it is. And, before long, we may be plunged into a Middle East war, and worrying about COVID and the American election will be, just yesterday's news.
OK, well, let's go back to look at the UK now for a little while. And this week, some pretty shocking stuff in last week's Mail on Sunday, a fascinating article about the disappearance of various scientists over in Wuhan. Not just the first person that caught the disease, but, other scientists as well. And that was, well, I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Lots of stuff coming out. The idea, of course, that the Pentagon had a big operation going on over there. So if this is the China virus, maybe it was the Pentagon China virus. Do you want to just say what you make of that idea, Martin? Is it possible?
Well, I mean, you can see that the Trump administration and the Murdoch press in Australia are pushing the idea, and you heard it in Trump's speech there, that the Chinese deliberately leaked this virus. They could have stopped it, but they didn't, etc. etc. Now, it's logically possible that it leaked from their Wuhan laboratory, but it's perfectly logically possible that it was actually smuggled into China by Western deep state for two reasons. A, they want to smash the Chinese economy. We're no longer going to tolerate China, as Pompeo said. And don't forget, they've had all sorts of problems inside China with swine flu and with bird flu. And then human flu. And at the same time, they've allowed it to flow back over the US and through the West, because they got an excuse to bail out the banking system for the second time since 2008. The banking system started to collapse in the US in September. In November, the Times of Israel reports that the Israeli Defense Forces were tipped off by the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States of America that a pandemic was coming out of China in November. And September, you've got the markets collapse. November, the IDF are tipped off, and then it all starts to happen. And it takes a while for the Chinese to work out what's going on. They're a bit panicked. They're trying to work out what it is. And then eventually they realise what's going on, and then they lock down. And, of course, they've been much more successful in controlling COVID than the US has been.
We've got some actually really quite good news this week, again from the Mail. New mutation of coronavirus may be a good thing. Strain common in Europe, America and parts of Asia is more infectious but less deadly, expert claims. A mutated strain, D614G, seems to be more infectious but less deadly than the original. Top expert says maybe that's a good thing, as it could lower the death rate. Well, obviously the death rate is going lower and lower all the time. Dr. Paul Tambaya said most viruses tend to become less virulent as they mutate. And Martin, this would of course correlate with this whole idea that this maybe was a man-made virus, because the various things that the geneticists would add to a virus, as the thing mutates, they are likely to fall away. So one of the spin-offs of all of this, of course, is that if people are getting tested, they may have the new strain of the virus, which is actually far less deadly. So that's actually a very positive sign that this doctor's come up with here.
Well, potentially so. Let's hope so. We're still not clear whether this is. I mean, I've read other things.
I mean, you could say, who is he? Okay, let's just have a look at who he is. Paul Tambaya, senior consultant at the National University of Singapore and president-elect of the International Society of Infectious Diseases. Evidence suggests the proliferation of the D614G mutation has coincided with a drop in death rates, suggesting it's less lethal. So a mutation is likely to actually... We're going to see less function of a virus as it mutates.
Well, hopefully so. I mean, I've read other stuff this week that suggested that it may have come from South China, from mines which were full of bat droppings, because people who were digging these bat droppings out started dying of COVID. Now, there's loads of, you know, there's still loads and loads of information, disinformation.
Well, look, looking at the death rates in the UK, as you can see the graph, I don't know if you can see that. I'll certainly put this graph up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. The UK coronavirus death toll as of yesterday, August the 7th, 17th, it shows a declining trend in mortality, unknown which strain each individual dies of, but D614G, believed to be the most infectious and least deadly, is thought to be dominant now in the UK. So it's almost as if nature's taken its course here. This thing, which was potentially, anyway, put out by the military or somebody along those lines, has slowly but surely run out of steam.
Yeah, well, if this is true... it's good news because it basically means people can be infected and therefore not even vaccinated.
This would explain
without dying or getting really ill.
Okay, so
we can't presume
but
anything.
If this is true, okay, it's a great big if. If this is true, it means that the people who are testing positive, and it would be an explanation as to why so many people have been testing positive after being contact traced for COVID-19 say they haven't got any symptoms. Because actually, what they're dealing with is a fairly, denuded strain of this. Anyway, I thought we'd have a listen to your favourite doctor, who is Martin, Dr. Vernon Coleman, who's living over in France now. He's the former British doctor, if I can find him. And here is his, I think, witty, humorous quip on the social implications as well of what's been going on with the pandemic this week.
In a document re-released from the British government's official advisers at SAGE, surely the most unsuitable acronym in history, confirms what I've been saying for months, that their advice to the government was to use the media to increase a sense of personal threat and to increase a sense of responsibility to others. May I remind you that we pay the fat salaries of these utter nutsards. Instead of looking after us, calming our fears and making us feel less stressed, they've deliberately been doing everything they could to terrorise us and to ramp up the scare stories. Distrust the government, avoid mass media, and fight the lies. Meanwhile, the leaders of the four nations in the United Kingdom have been doing everything possible to create confusion and extra anxiety. I plucked up the courage to take a look at the BBC website the other day and found the official rules on how and when people are allowed to meet one another. These are the official rules from the BBC website. In England, 6 people from multiple households or up to 30 people from 2 households can meet together outdoors. They mustn't get closer than 3 foot 3 inches. In Scotland, up to 15 people from up to 5 households can meet as long as they all keep 6 foot 6 inches apart. In Wales, any number of people from 2 households can meet as long as they're 6 foot 6 inches apart. And in Northern Ireland, up to 30 people can meet outdoors but must keep 3 foot 3 inches apart. The rules are equally confusing for indoor meetings. In England, 2 households can meet together. In Scotland, 8 people from 3 households can meet. In Wales, 2 households can form 1 extended household, whatever that means. It sounds like Welsh wife swapping to me. And in Northern Ireland, 10 people from 4 households can meet. There's no advice on what happens to citizens who live on a border between the two countries. The one conclusion from all this utter is that there's no science to any of this. Idiot civil servants and politicians have clearly made it all up. I bet they couldn't stop laughing to themselves as they wrote this garbage. Meanwhile, there's increasing evidence that less and less deaths are being marked down to COVID-19 and more people are immune. The testing is a nonsense, as unreliable as Tony Blair, but as the positives turn up with predictable regularity, so governments use the results as an excuse for more and more and tougher laws. There's no longer any doubt that health policy is being used to achieve geopolitical goals. We are at war with our own governments, with many of our universities, and with much of our media. In fact, virtually all of it, mainstream media. In the long term, we need to sweep clean the stables and create a new political and administrative system. We need new leaders, new media, and new management. Our politicians and public servants have done worse than fail us. They have betrayed us. Thank you for watching An Old Man in a Chair, and thank you for all your support and encouragement.
Okay, that's Dr. Vernon Coleman there, the author of How to Stop Your Doctor Killing You. He's been going a long, long time. I've been following him for years, and it's really interesting. He seems to have become a kind of almost. I mean, his YouTube channel has done extremely well. Anyway, what do you make of him saying, actually, we need a new way of doing things completely? I mean, you might not agree with what he says on the COVID, but there is this whole idea coming along, isn't there, of the Great Reset, and he's saying we need something completely different.
Well, in that case, he's saying we need a Great Reset. It's just his version of a Great Reset, if you like, and certainly there is going to be a Great Reset, if you like, of one kind or another.
Isn't there going to be a competition?
The question is who's going to run it. Yeah.
Exactly. So, who's in the running for that? Is it just the World Economic Forum and Prince Charles and Davos? Are they the only people who are going to really determine
it? I think the Chinese Communist Party have got some plans, if you're thinking about who the real competition is.
Okay, so this, you were talking about sort of development banks, etc. Yep. Russia and China are involved
I mean, basically, what's going on? You talk about we're at war. Well, we are at war. People in Beirut know we're at war. People in Iraq know we're at war.
Talking about an information war.
No, I know, but I mean, it's a bit irritating that he uses this term war when what he means is, we're disagreeing about using face masks. There is actually a war going on. People are dying every day. Have been for decades. We're totally involved in it in this country. We've got soldiers all over the world backing it all up, and intelligence officers and all the rest of it.
If you can't warm to Vernon Coleman, how about Peter Hitchens? Because I know in the past you've been quite supportive of him, haven't you?
Well, he's been quite sensible about Syria, but apart from that, he's a silly Tory in my view.
Okay,
there you go.
Let's have a listen to what Peter Hitchens has been saying. He looks upon this as a bit of a mind control exercise, but here he is talking on talk radio last week.
My side should now perhaps adopt the view of the government. We need to frighten people more to get to get them to realise how serious what's going on is. Mm. You remember that the extraordinary SAGE document back on March the 22nd, in which the government experts said a substantial number of people still do not feel sufficiently personally threatened.
Yeah.
The perceived level of personal threat needs to be increased among those who are complacent, using hard-hitting emotional messaging. The following day, the day after that piece of advice was delivered, they shut down the economy and introduced mass house arrest. Mm. And it's all been based on fear. And very effective it is, too. People in huge masses are afraid of something which isn't really a menace to them. Well, they're not afraid of something which is the invasion of their privacy and of their personal freedom, and indeed the takeover of the state by effectively a very small body of people, unaccountable, shortly to move into a special space-age office in the Cabinet Office, completely uncontrolled by Parliament, completely unrestrained by the judiciary. We are effectively living in a country which is turning into an autocracy. While I am absolutely not an apologist for Mr. Lukashenko in Belarus, it seems quite funny for everyone to getting so pious about his obviously rigged elections and his repression, as we in our own country head towards our own version of an unfree, lawless, autocratic state. Most people conform. Most people do. And this is what people do. This is a country where we make rude jokes about the number of French people who collaborated with their occupiers. What do you think we would have done if we'd been occupied by people who shot and tortured anyone who came? But even we don't even need to be shot and tortured, do we? We just need somebody to say, we'll fine you 50 quid if you don't wear.
Well,
actually, the British law on this, or the English law on this, to be more specific, is actually quite open to allow dissent. Mm. Which people could use if they wanted to, and this is the amazing thing, people don't. But they're saying this to look tough. They know perfectly well that the levels of compliance are extremely high.
Yeah.
It's just done in much in the way that Priti Patel pretends to be tough on immigration. It's just done to look tough, not to be tough.
Yeah.
To actually mobilize the police to go around grabbing everybody in the street who wasn't wearing a muzzle and dragging them in and forcing them to pay fines. They're not going to do that.
You've got Italian military people hanging out of planes with binoculars staring at people on a beach to see whether they're not lying on a sunbed.
Well, you have to ask yourself, as with all photographs, how, like all those pictures of mass graves and huge piles of coffins and all the rest of it that we saw at the beginning of this, how do these pictures come to be taken?
Well, presumably there's a press guy in the plane.
Yeah, and who asked him up? I mean, you try and get a trip in a military plane normally. The point is, any photograph like that, you have to ask yourself, how did it come to be taken? And the answer is, obviously, these things are arranged.
Yeah.
It's the idea that if the Italian Air Force spots somebody out of line on the beach, the plane is going to swoop low, and from loudspeakers on its wings, and terrible imprecations going. Well, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's terribly surreal.
It creates an atmosphere of surveillance which gullible people, and there are a lot of gullible people.
There really are.
Will fall for.
Yeah.
As I keep stressing, my own life is one of great good fortune, and I'm probably largely left alone. But I do grieve for the country. You know, you sit down, you read George Orwell's thoughts about the English people. This is a country where people say, you can't run me in for that. You can't do that here. And these statements were true. Mm. And it simply was the case until quite recently. That it really was different here. The government did have more limited powers over us than practically anywhere else in the world. And it's vanishing before our eyes, and nobody cares. Yeah. I have to be upset by that, surely. If I weren't upset by that, there'd be something wrong with me.
That's Peter Hitchens invoking George Orwell there, Martin. He's a bit of a chameleon, isn't he?
Yeah, well, George Orwell gets invoked by lots of people. He was actually a tout for MI5 and MI6. He grassed loads of people up who were communists, in his view.
Peter Hitchens, not George Orwell.
Well, no, I'm talking about George Orwell.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they were all there, all had their careers ruined. So Orwell the saint is he's a saint to some people. He was no more better or worse than many other people. The idea that Hitchens has got that one time Britain was a free country and then gradually it's all been taken away, I think it's just rubbish. I mean, basically it's always been a pretty conformist place. In the 1950s, people were given sarin up at Porton Town.
What he's saying, you've got to agree with the basic point here, is that the government is becoming useless, more useless. Over the years, it's slowly but surely, since World War II, and we're going to be hearing from Mohammed Rafiq in a minute, in the 1950s and 60s, it was fairly well organised. It's just going down, an almost terminal slide at the moment.
Well, what's happened is that the state used to be more omnipresent than it subsequently became. Don't forget we had rationing into the 1950s, for example. But at the same time, the state also actually did a reasonable job of things like providing schools and buses. What's happened is that the state has become weaker and weaker at doing the stuff that we want it to do, but more and more overblown at doing the stuff we don't want it to do, like invading Iraq. Trump mentioned there Biden supported the invasion of Iraq. So did virtually the 100% of the Republican Party. It caused 1 million people to die. It's still not over. The war goes on, but it's all just electoral gains for us. Biden supported it. And the current government in this country, Boris Johnson and all the rest of them, they all supported it. And then they go on about, well, that's nothing to do with us. That was Blair. You supported all of that. And, of course, the consequences for countries that decide to go to war with other countries, like Iraq, is that you end up with bombs going off and people being killed in your own country.
Okay, as a way to round off, we're going to be hearing a bit more from him next week, because we're going to be doing a 9/11 special for a couple of hours next week with Ian Henshaw, who'll be dropping in on Bristol. That's what he's told me earlier on today anyway, the author on 9/11, and doing a bit of a comparison, because it's funnily enough, Ian was one of the first people on the BBC World News who was interviewed about COVID-19 in Britain, because it was his next door neighbour who was supposed to be the first carrier of the illness into the UK, even though he didn't seem to be very ill. And also, as we know, there's lots of evidence that the disease was circulating in the UK well before it was supposed to have been in March. And in fact, probably here in Bristol, the BBC Natural History Unit on the 17th of December, and a crew flew in and spread it around in the BBC offices, although they haven't actually reported that yet. Maybe they never will. So what do you make of this idea, Martin, that actually it was quite widespread in possibly the Icelandic people said it was the Alps that it was mainly in, but it was spreading to Iceland from there and from the UK, that it was in the UK, possibly the US, but certainly in some of these countries well before it was even supposed to exist?
There's plenty of people who are saying exactly that, but I come back to the Times of Israel saying that the Defence Intelligence Agency of the United States said to the Israeli Defence Forces that there was going to be a pandemic in China the following month. How did the DIA know that?
Good question. Right. Well, we're going to hear now from former psychological warfare officer Scott Bennett. He certainly believes that there's elements of psychological warfare involved in the way the media is being used in the COVID-19 so-called pandemic, which certainly, if you look at the graph on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, looks to have been over about 2 months ago. And so let's have a listen to Scott Bennett, what he makes now of the success or otherwise of the polio vaccines. We heard on the BBC and other Western news networks this week the great news that polio has now been gotten rid of in Africa. Actually, the fact of the matter is it's still there. It's actually only a vaccine induced polio. So there is polio, but it's been put there by vaccines, not by the natural polio. Anyway, let's see what Scott Bennett has to say about that and COVID-19 a bit more generally now.
We've seen Indian children, thousands of Indian children, come down with polio after Bill Gates's vaccines. We've seen the Italian politician stand up in the Italian parliament and condemn Bill Gates as a criminal for his vaccine poisoning of people.
Well, that's right. She said he should be arrested, didn't she?
Yes, and he should be arrested. He should be charged for war crimes and executed for the damage that he's done. And he's openly said depopulation of the earth is his objective. So this is an instrument. This is a means to an end, is through this false vaccination. So I'm opposed to it, absolutely. The COVID-19 thing, as far as I'm concerned, I don't believe much of it. I don't buy into it. I think, if anything, it is a result of a combination of the chemtrails that they've been polluting the air with and all sorts of other toxicities. There's also a branch that ties it in with 5G technology deployment is having a poisoning effect on the cells. There's a lot of different areas that need to be examined, but the psychosis that is being infected in the populations is very palpable. You can see the media, hear the politicians like Joe Biden demanding that everyone wear a mask. Well, that dehumanizes people. That disconnects people. That puts people in a state of fear.
Yeah, but it might save your life, Scott.
That's the cultic presentation. It'll save your life if you just stay in your basement, don't come out, wear a mask, and starve to death by not working, and keep your children home to be on video monitors like 1984, and that's their education. We've witnessed a shackling of human society, but I don't think it's going to take root and last, because we said the president and really American society only had a couple months before this would start to explode. And right after a couple months went by, when people agreed to shut down, they didn't know what this was all about. But yet the media and the politicians on the Democrat side were hysterical that everything needed to be stopped, all businesses, all people locked in their homes and forced to wear masks. A couple months after that, people started breaking out, and then you had the George Floyd protests and the violence, which seemed to be engineered with a lot of Antifa, Black Lives Matter, LGBT protestations combining into a militant revolutionary wing that is causing massive disruptions in the cities in the United States. Okay.
So, Martin, a lot in there. I wouldn't necessarily go along with him invoking the whole idea of chemtrails having really anything to do with it whatsoever. But he's saying there that he believes that there's an element of engineering to some of these Black Lives Matter demonstrations. Is that possible? Is it? I mean, because we've seen this sort of thing in Ukraine, we've seen it in Belarus, we've seen the whole color revolution system happening in many countries, actually. Is it feasible that this kind of thing is now rolling out here? And has it been, the elites been doing this for generations, you know, organizing protests, having various groups on the streets that they want for their own political purposes?
Well, even if it was spontaneous, they'd want to infiltrate it and manipulate it. And, of course, there's an element that the Black Lives Matter movement is amorphous. You've got kind of official spokespeople who are paid for by corporations. Frankly, that's where the money comes from. And you've also got random people who are just identifying with it because they saw something on their Twitter feed. And of course they've been manipulating. Gladio was running in Western Europe for many years. They were running both fascist terrorists, left-wing terrorist groups, and it was all being orchestrated from inside the military-industrial complex. And of course people can be genuinely, I mean, a lot of people who were members of the Red Brigades, for example, were genuine left-wing terrorist militants. But the Red Brigades itself was ultimately controlled by the CISMI, and they were the ones who kidnapped and assassinated the Prime Minister.
Well, we also had anarchist attacks here in Bristol, didn't we? Is any hint that maybe they were manipulated?
Well, yeah, but there was supposedly an anarchist attack on, if you remember, on the they burnt down the police firearms training place out at Portishead. And I don't think that was carried out by anybody I knew or had any, you know, it's too big a job.
Well, they wouldn't tell you, would they?
Well, no, but in any case, it's too big a job. It's just not likely that they did. And the fact is that the police officers were murdered by Gladio terrorists in the 1970s. You know, it's quite feasible. I've been on RT this week talking about the Navalny poisoning, whatever it is, but it's quite likely that Navalny would be poisoned by Western agents who are trying to create a conflict with Russia. People say they wouldn't do stuff like that. I say that's just not the case. We know that the Special Demonstration Squad in Britain from the 1960s onwards infiltrated literally hundreds of plainclothes police officers into virtually every movement anybody listening to this show has ever been involved in. CND, you know, Save the Whale, all of it totally infiltrated. SWP. And then, you know, we've already got a police state. So when, you know, privileged posh boys like Peter Hitchens going about, we used to live in freedom. It just makes me laugh, give a hollow laugh. You may have done, the rest of us haven't.
Can you just give us your take on, for those of you, Martin, the very few out there that didn't hear you and didn't see you on Russia Today this week, what's your take on the so-called poisoning of Navalny? He's now been brought over to Germany, hasn't he?
Well, I was called out almost as soon as we'd heard what had happened. They said, well, can you make a comment on this? Well, what happened was something happened and he was on a plane, and it was a standard plane. It wasn't a private plane, and they immediately landed it, and he was immediately taken to hospital. And he's basically diabetic. He said he's diabetic. So that's by far the most likely explanation. He's just had a diabetic attack. But of course, they then allowed him to be flown to Germany, where he's been placed basically under the control of the BND, the German intelligence services. And they've got a line to spin, which is that he's been poisoned. And I saw Johnson wading in today saying, oh, well, he's obviously been poisoned and we must do, you know, more sanctions, etc.
Oh dear.
Now, in other words, why would the Russian state, deep state or Putin, want, if they wanted to kill him, surely they would have killed
him. I'll tell you why, because he's the main opposition.
No, he's
in
not
Russia.
The main opposition.
Well, that's what the BBC World Service has been saying.
Whenever he stood for election, Navalny has got absolutely derisory.
His big success was in 2012 when he got 30% of the vote to be mayor of Moscow. And since then, he's basically nobody.
Well, no, he's not nobody. He's somebody.
Well, he's not a winner of elections.
But the whole way in which this whole thing is presented in the West is ridiculous. The biggest opposition party in Russia to Putin is the Communist Party, and they nearly won the election in the 1990s, but bombs went off, orchestrated probably by the Russian secret services working with the West to prevent them winning the election. Lukashenko, I hate to say it, but it's quite clear that he did win the election. He didn't get 80% of the vote. He probably got something like 65-70% of the vote. But he definitely won it. And the reason he won it is exactly that they were going on about having strikes in the Minsk tractor factory last week. Hardly anybody has gone on strike from the Minsk tractor factory. A couple of hundred people walked out with us. They employ thousands. And the reason is because if the opposition won the election, which they didn't, the first thing they'd do is close the Minsk tractor factory and send everybody.
Sell it off. Sell it to a Western company.
Yeah, but they wouldn't sell it off, because what would happen is, what's happened is that the big companies in Belarus are all linked to the agricultural economy. So they produce tractors and fertilizer. And,
I bet they produce them cheaper than a lot of the tractors and the fertilizer that British farmers buy. Indeed,
they've got very low cost base, so that's why they're able to continue functioning. But also the other thing, of course, that they're able to continue functioning is because they get loads of cheap gas and oil from the Russians. So, you know, and basically that's in the interest of the Russians, just to keep them all. I mean, and that's why Lukashenko has stayed in power for 26 years. But he said, I'm not going to change all of that. We're going to carry on doing exactly the same as we've always done it.
Let's just get back to Russia for a minute and Navalny. What do you think is really at the heart of this, though? Because we keep hearing, don't we, about him being a great opposition hero that Putin is so jealous of. And yet, actually, it's the Chinese... Sorry, not the Chinese. The Russian Communist Party is still very strong in politics. Where are the real opposition to Putin? Because this is what he's always presented as the main opposition to Putin. But actually, that seems to be only in the Western media. Nowhere else in the world. Not in diplomatic or, ambassadorial circles. Nowhere does this guy feature, really, apart from in the Western press. But so who is the real opposition
to Putin? Well, you've got two sources of real opposition to Putin. One is the Communist Party. Zyuganov was the president of that, but they put up a different guy to stand in the last election. But they got 17-20% of the vote, far in excess of anything Navalny's ever got. The other main opposition is the Liberal Democrat Party, which is not like Tim Kent's Liberal Democrat Party. They really are Russian nationalists. Incidentally, Navalny is also a Russian nationalist. He doesn't like foreigners or immigrants and so on. So he's presented in the West as this great liberal guy. But in actual fact, his views are rather illiberal when it comes to that. But of course, he's regarded in the West, frankly, as many of, Ksenia Sobchak and others, as basically Western puppets. I mean, basically, they're paid by the Americans. They get full salaries
Just round this off by explaining why you think it's feasible that the West is behind this and not Putin?
All right, well, let's just see what happened in the Maidan Square in 2014. Loads of pro-EU demonstrators were shot through the head by snipers, and so were several police officers. And on the back of that, there was a coup which forced Yanukovych out of the country, even though he'd just done a deal with the opposition the day before, and a new regime came in. The police officers from the Berkut police were arrested, and they were charged with shooting the demonstrators. There's been a court case in Kiev which showed that they did not shoot the demonstrators. The demonstrators were shot by a group of 50 assassins who were brought in with Shakashvili, who was fishing in those waters, used to be president of Georgia, is very pro-Western. They orchestrated the shooting of those people. And that's been reported in Kiev. I mean, it's good to say that.
Why does this mean Navalny?
Let me come to this. So that shows that the Western intelligence services, NATO intelligence services, were quite prepared to shoot up to 80 pro-EU, pro-Western demonstrators in order to overthrow the regime. Navalny is a puppet and therefore expendable. And as I said on RT, if he has been poisoned, the first question the police have got to ask is who had access to him, who's in his entourage. Because in actual fact, the West is quite capable of murdering low-level people to create trouble.
Is it even possible that he may be killed in Germany and that blamed on Putin?
Well, they'll have to find, if that's what, at the moment, he's in a stable condition in the German hospital. but they've said they can't find any poison, but he must have been poisoned. And the Russian doctors have all said that's an insult to us. You know, we saved, they've all said,
apparently it was,
they saved his life. They said, but we couldn't trace
any
poison.
Saying on the World Service this morning that it was actually a nerve agent.
Well, I mean, what they're doing there is they're just repeating the same old themes. What's happened here is he's had what looks like a diabetic attack, a chlorinase suppression of whatever. But lots of things cause that. If it was nerve agent, it would have killed the whole of Salisbury. And if he'd been poisoned with nerve agent, everybody on the plane would be dead. It's just nonsense. But it's creating this image, Putin the poisoner. Putin, he poisons people. Oh, yes, but we all know that Putin poisons people, except we don't. We do know that NATO intelligence services kill pro-EU demonstrators. What should follow on from that is the Kiev police should start to say, right, we know that a US colonel was involved in this, because the people who testified from Georgia said a US colonel gave us the instructions. They should be sending to the United States of America, right, we want to extradite that person to stand trial in Kiev. They're not going to do that because they're a puppet state. But at the same time, they had to release the riot police because they didn't do the shootings. NATO intelligence services. And the rumours I've heard is that they were brought in via the Warsaw Police Academy, where they were given their instructions by British Army officers. Now, maybe those British Army officers should stand trial in Kiev for mass murder. And then maybe people would begin to understand how vicious NATO intelligence services actually are.
Well, it wouldn't be so surprising, wouldn't it? Because we've had so many former Nazis actually incorporated into NATO after World War II. So there seems to have been almost a kind of Nazi continuity network going on.
Well, what we're dealing with here is the techniques and the standard operating procedures. They are quite capable of very devious behaviour. So that the Prime Minister of Italy is kidnapped ostensibly by a left-wing terrorist group, but in actual fact by elements from the state itself. And he was a moderate, middle-of-the-road guy, and they made sure that he died because he wanted to bring the Communist Party into the sharing in the government of Italy.
All this organised by Licio Gelli and his P2 committee that were actually running the country.
Well, indeed. And, of course, they didn't stop doing this at the end of the Cold War. And, of course, I think it's quite significant what happened in Kiev, because it's quite clear that NATO, in 2014, assassinated pro-Western demonstrators in order to carry out a coup.
So
that's how vicious they are.
Impossible. Anyway, Martin, thank you for giving us actually probably a fuller version than you gave to Russia Today on that particular story. Anyway, we're going to move now to look at something a bit more local. We did hear last week about disgruntled St. Paul's residents feeling that they'd had no consultation at all over a massive 5G mast which has gone up in St. Paul's here in Bristol. And one of the arguments, of course, which is put forward by people like Freya Lockwood, who will not reply to my phone calls or texts or messages or emails, only to say I've got to ask Bristol City Council, and then they never reply when I want to try and get her to talk about Bristol smart cities and how wonderful 5G supposedly is. What they'll tell you is that it cannot cause cancer. Well, the actual argument used by most of the pro 5G people is they say, well, actually microwaves are not ionizing radiation, and they're quite right. If you look at the spectrum of the electromagnetic spectrum, you go up in frequency from microwaves, and then you start getting towards visible light. You go through the visible light spectrum, and it's only once you get to the end of that with ultraviolet light and on beyond to X-rays and gamma radiation that you actually start getting ionizing radiation. And they're basically saying that it's only ionizing radiation at the very top end of the spectrum, well away from these microwaves that are used for 5G, 4G and the rest, that you're likely to get cancer. Well, actually, according to the Environmental Health Trust and Dr. Deborah Davis, that's complete nonsense. So let's have a little listen to her and what she's got to say about microwaves causing cancer now.
Mobile phones do not pop popcorn. That was a fraud. They don't make any heat that we know of, otherwise they wouldn't be permitted. But they do go through things that contain fat and fluid. And we are now working in Environmental Health Trust with scientists at the University of California, San Francisco, scientists at formerly the president of the American Cancer Society of California, because we are seeing women who keep cell phones in their bras. Has anyone seen a woman put a cell phone in her bra? Hands up, please. Please tell them you've heard now why they shouldn't do that. And here I want to show you our first case report from 2009, and we now have many more. This was a Chinese-American woman a Chinese-American woman who used her cell phone 4 hours a day in her bra for 10 years while she was driving. Now, and you drive with a phone on your body. The phone is smart. It's going to go from one tower to another, and it's going to say, here I am, where are you, here I am. And it's going to be going to max power each time it moves from one cell tower to another. And there it was right next to her chest. And the tumors that developed, developed right under the antenna of the phone. Unusual tumors. Well, you know, that's a very good question. Does it apply to males who would put the phone in their breast pocket? We actually have cases now of men with unusual skin cancers or unusual growths where they've kept their phone in one place. And again, if they were test, phones would not be past testing approval if they were to do that. Male breast cancer is very rare, very, very rare. But we are seeing some reports of cases. And here, unfortunately, this is an MRI of a young woman, a very brave young woman named Tiffany France. When she was 21, she's now 22, she developed metastatic breast cancer. This is metastases into her chest wall right here. And this outlined the phone. And it was subcutaneous, so it's like right under the surface of the skin. It was not deep within the breast. Most breast cancer occurs in women over 50. It occurs in the upper outer quadrant. These tumors occurred right under the antenna of the phone. And now we have 38 of them. Not a single one of them has a family history. None of them has inherited the defects that we know increase the risk of breast cancer. They have multifocal tumors. That means they have more than one tumor, and the tumors are located under the antenna, sometimes just right in the center of the chest. So we're collecting information because that's what we do in science. But we want to, in the meantime, issue precautionary advice because that's also what we do in public health when it comes to setting public policy. When it comes to further work on the prenatal impacts, my colleagues at Yale University have taken mice, exposed them to mobile phone radiation, and they have found significant effects on those mice's behavior as adults. All right? Prenatally exposed mice have hyperactivity as adults. And these are some of the data. They have worse memory. They're more hyperactive. They have more anxiety. And because of that, that is why we've developed the Baby Safe Project, working with colleagues at Yale University and around the world. Now, how many of you had heard that in 2011, the World Health Organization had reviewed all of the evidence and decided that mobile phone radiation was a possible human carcinogen? How many people had heard that? Okay. It's interesting that that information isn't more widely known, and we can explore the reasons for that perhaps at a later time. But the fact is, the group that reviewed this evidence for the World Health Organization looked at all the evidence at the time in 2011. At that time, they said it's important to conduct additional research and it's important to take pragmatic measures to reduce exposure. But we are not conducting additional research. And in fact, the World Health Organization itself is no longer conducting a leading study on brain cancer and mobile phones.
So that's Dr. Deborah Davis from Environmental Health Trust. Terrific video, as not seen on the BBC, all about how dangerous microwaves are. And there's particularly all sorts of stuff about bees as well, Martin, we're going to hear about in a minute. But it's quite clear that the industry has decided it's going to lie to the world and say, well, because it's not ionizing radiation that's coming out of these phones and these masts, that it can't cause cancer. Well, that's just not true.
I don't know enough to say for sure. I mean, that's a fairly strong presentation that lady made. No doubt the other side will have other things to say about it. But, I mean...
She's making a very strong argument, isn't she? She's saying basically the research is funded by them and it's all pretty much controlled.
Yeah, which is why you have the precautionary principle, isn't it? If you don't know whether something's dangerous or not, then you presume that it is until you can prove that it isn't.
What about this idea of research wonks up at universities saying, well, actually, at the end of the day, they're only going to do the research if they can come out at the end of it and say, it was a conclusion, actually, we need to do more research, because then that's another job for them.
That's true. But we've got this problem with anything that human beings do. There are vested interests, whether financial or just intellectual. You know, people don't like being wrong. They want to be right. They generally believe they are right. Otherwise, they wouldn't believe what they believe. And, you know, it's very hard to disentangle who's telling the truth.
Well, we were hearing from Tim Kent about special educational needs here in Bristol, about that being a war by parents having to try and get some, you know, their statutory legal rights for their children to be educated, which is a horrific position to put parents in. Thank you very much, Bristol City Council. But here she talks about, this is Deborah Davis again, talks about wargaming, the mobile phone research, which is an incredible idea, is that they've sat down, these companies, this is what she's found, and they've decided that it's a war. We want to get our technologies out there. There's all sorts of people that want to stop us, that actually, for example, value human health, and it's they're going to wargame it. So that's what she ends up concluding here in this next section from Dr. Deborah Davis from Environment and Health Trust.
Where you stand on an issue depends on where you sit and who's bought your chair. And there's a tremendous amount of sponsored research by people who are hired to do studies to find no effect. And that's plagued this field in a number of countries, including within the government itself. So I don't know about the details here with Arpanza, but I can tell you in the United States today, the gentleman who is directing the Federal Communications Commission, Tom Wheeler, was for 10 years the executive director of the Cell Phone Telecommunications Industry Association. And now he's in charge of regulating those devices. So it's challenging to have a neutral playing field under that circumstance. One example, the U.S. Congress asked for a study of what needed to be done on mobile phone radiation in 1993, in 1998, in 2002, in 2012. That's how many times they've asked for that study to be done. So each time a study is done, and each time the conclusion is reached, we need more research. We need more research. Well, that's my bread and butter. Of course we need more research. But if instead of funding the research, all you're doing is calling for it, then it becomes a bit of a smokescreen. So that's part of our challenge on this issue. It's a lot easier to call for research than it is to carry it out. This research is hard to do. It's not simple. There are real complexities to this field. Unfortunately, at least in the past, industry had a very clear strategy. And in my book, Disconnect, I document and quote in the new afterword that in 1994, when industry first became aware that there were studies suggesting that mobile phone radiation could damage brain cells of rats, a memo was written to, quote, war-game the science. War-game the science. This issue is far too important to be gamed. It's not a matter of war. It's a matter of the future health of your children and grandchildren.
Oh, well, we're leaving the European Union, Martin, and it's the EU regulators who decide whether mobile phones are safe or not. The only problem is we've just had a report out a month or so, maybe 2 months ago, from two members of the European Parliament saying basically the industry controls this group, so the industry is writing its own rules.
Yeah, it's what's called regulatory capture in the economics textbooks. And if you think about it, it's pretty obvious, because you've got people who are basically part of the industry. They then become the regulators of the industry. And then when they finish being regulators, they go back to making money from the industry, whatever industry it is. And it could be, and of course we're talking here about mobile phones, but it could be anything really. And it's a real struggle. I mean, there isn't an easy answer. because what you want is to have a state that's sufficiently independent to be able to regulate the private sector, but not to be beholden or have its own agenda, for example. I mean, one of the things, if you think about radar in World War II, people who were operating radars were told that it was perfectly safe. We now know that it wasn't safe at all, and that the people who were operated radar had all sorts of long-term consequences. But at the time, when you're trying to win the Battle of Britain, the long-term consequences for the people operating the radar aren't the first thing on the agenda. And that's real warfare, which actually really does lead to corners being cut, like the creation of the vaccine for flu, which probably caused the Spanish flu epidemic. Originally at a base in the US in Kansas. And of course they're cutting corners because they need to get their soldiers out to the front line with the flu injections already inside them. Same with Gulf War syndrome from the first Gulf War, where they basically knocked them up with loads and loads of vaccines against what they thought Saddam Hussein might have because they'd supplied it to him. So you can see you've got two forces at work here. One is the corporate desire to just make money and not think about the consequences. You've also got the intellectual arrogance of people who've developed new technologies and they want them to go forward. And then you've also got the military. For example, 5G clearly has all sorts of military applications, and it may well be that the Chinese, for example, are pioneering all of this because they want to be at the cutting edge of the military implications.
Martin, what military application does 5G possibly have? I mean, admittedly, the whole idea of mobile phone data was originally a military concept. The idea was that you could speak to people in the battlefield and you could actually use that data connection to them to download maps and things like that, things that they needed to know about, for example.
That's right.
And that's where the mobile phone industry and data industry on mobile phone actually sprang from.
Yes, and the whole internet came out of, Pentagon spending, because the private sector won't invest enough money to develop the technologies concerned. So you often find cutting-edge technology is driven by military expenditure, and that goes back, in history, you'll see that the creation of the Bank of England, the Royal Navy, all of this was basically a military industrial complex in embryo, which of course continues to function to this day with much the same sort of agenda as it always had.
Well, we're going to go and have a listen now to a chap called Mohammed Rafiq, who sadly died a couple of weeks ago. He was a guy who used to work at the Bank of England. In fact, Martin, he was working there very hard and diligently during the Big Bang in the 1980s. I think it was 1986?
Seven, I think.
Margaret Thatcher and Victor Rothschild decided they were going to digitise everything that was done in the City of London. This is something that many people don't realise, that before that date, all various deals to do with exchange of share certificates, bearer bonds, all these sorts of financial transactions in the City of London. Many of them, Martin, used to be done by courier. So a guy on a motorbike with a share certificate or a piece of paper of whatever sort in a leather briefcase on a motorcycle would go from one bank to another and get a document signed, and everything had to be finished by the end of the day, and it was done in that way, in all physical bits of paper. But obviously the whole digital world changed all that. Do you think there was really much difference between what was going on with motorcycle couriers and bits of paper and the digital world?
Well, there's technological change in what's went on, as you pointed out, but more to the point is the changes in the regulations about what banks could and couldn't do. And so in the US, for example, in the 90s, they abolished the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated investment banking, i.e. speculation, from normal retail banking, where people put their funds in order to pay for their retirement or whatever. And, That was the fundamental change. And of course, we're now in a ridiculous world where BlackRock, which is a private hedge fund in the US, is now deciding who's going to get government bailouts to keep the show on the road to get Trump re-elected or not elected or whatever the plan is.
I mean, is there any real proposal from the Labour Party at the moment on any kind of sensible reform of the City of London?
Well, you'll find that no doubt people are making some noises in that direction, and people like Richard Murphy, tax Justice Network.
Well, he seems to be gone completely from the scene now. When John McDonnell's left now, so these people have now been jettisoned from the party.
Yeah, well, I think even the more right wing members of the party can see that we've had another bailout of the financial services sector, just like in 2008. But of course, many of them think that that's just to do with COVID.
Well, I'd like to agree with you, but I seem to see most of the right wing sort of in the middle of fighting the left wing, and the left wing fighting the right wing. Anyway, let's have it before we hear from Mohammed Rafiq. This is a little bit cheeky, but it's a piece I was going to play in the first hour. We didn't have time for. And this is the former foreign secretary, Labour foreign secretary, and the guy who stood for Leader, along with his brother David Miliband. Sorry, Ed Miliband. And let's hear from David Miliband. This is what he was saying this week about what he thinks is too much infighting going on in the Labour Party at the moment, and who might be behind it.
One of the things that Keir Starmer is dealing with at the moment is the fall, the fight that the Labour Party still seems to be having about an election that happened 3 years ago, and this idea that Jeremy Corbyn would have won the 2017 election if only it weren't for people within his party. Do you believe that's right?
This is a pure wrecking tactic from Jeremy Corbyn and the Corbynites. Denial after four successive defeats is a route to more defeats. And we learnt that after 1992. We got out of denial and we won in 97. And actually, we won three elections on the trot. And if we don't really understand that when people got a look at Labour in 2017, we couldn't beat the worst Tory campaign in history, 750,000 votes we were behind. And then when people got the full measure of Jeremy Corbyn in 2019, he led us to the worst election defeat since the 1930s. So it's a wrecking tactic, and I hope people understand it for what it is.
Well, he's calling it a wrecking tactic, Martin. Some on the left are saying, well, actually, we're just exposing the infiltration of the Labour Party machinery where people from the right were actually actively trying to undermine Corbyn and trying to stop him winning the election. Where do you stand on this one?
Well, if you'll actually look at what actually happened, Ed Miliband did reasonably well, but Corbyn did better. So the idea that by moving to the right, they would have done better, it's not the case. When you look at what happened in the and he lost by a few thousand votes in a few constituencies under first past the post.
This is in the 2017 general election.
But don't forget, but what's happened since then is that Scotland has decided to
in
go.
In fact, Theresa May was quite confident, wasn't she? She was so confident.
Oh,
she
yeah.
was going, oh, I'm going to get a massive, massive majority now. Actually, she got a bit of a surprise, didn't she, on election day?
She did. But what's also happened since David Miliband was in charge, and of course, he full-heartedly supported the invasion of Iraq, which of course made the Liberal Democrats take loads of Labour votes in cities like Bristol. And of course, he was involved in things like rendition and all the rest of it.
Well, let me just remind you as well, he was the host for Roland Dumas when he was invited over to London 2 years before the beginning of the Syrian so-called civil war, where he was being invited by British officials to participate in the overthrowing of the Syrian government. So he's certainly not a whiter than white character. I mean, he was the guy in charge at the time. He was foreign secretary.
Yeah, all right. But leaving aside him as an individual, you've definitely got a tension between the left and the right of the Labour Party. There's always been a tension going back to the 1930s. So it's not exactly news that there's still tension there. And of course, the fundamental problem for the right of the party is that with Scotland going its own way, Labour is not going to win in Scotland anytime soon. There's no way they can win just by winning the popular vote under first past the post. And this is where Corbyn's real mistake was. He should have come out in favour of proportional representation, as the left wing of the Labour Party did in New Zealand in the 1980s, and changed the electoral system. And they changed rugby union at the same time. They started to play it at a much faster pace with a lot more commitment. And of course, that was what should have happened in Britain. But they're stuck in the mud. Everybody just looks at the last election. David Miliband there just looks back to the Blair era as some kind of wonderful era.
Well, the Labour Party was actually in power.
Yes, and what did they do with it? Ultimately, they decided to invade Iraq to help the Americans out, which actually destroyed their own party. And that was likely
they
to
started,
destroy their
They also started these horrendous parasitic PFIs as well.
Indeed, that was Gordon Brown was responsible for PFIs, particularly, because it was a way of spending money without having
but
a
But on the positive side, we got the building of places like Cabot Circus here, so a massive investment in city centres.
Yeah, well, which is all about to go down the drain anyway because of what's going to happen next.
Maybe they'll be turned into luxury flats, are we going to see?
Indeed. The point about this is when he goes around, we've had the worst elections in the 1930s. The popular vote actually stood up. It's just that because of the electoral system and the fact that Scotland no longer votes Labour, you've got no chance of winning. Starmer's got no chance of winning either.
It's also undermining in your own party. That doesn't help, does it?
No, it doesn't. If you've got a situation where Corbyn had already become the leader, they should have let him have a go at trying to, but they didn't. They twice tried to remove him, which they couldn't do. So it was a pointless exercise, and all it did is entrench the hostility on the other side. But in other European countries, there'd be just two parties there. There'd be like Die Linke party in Germany and the SPD, and it wouldn't matter. You just have two parties, and people can decide which one.
So, what point is the Labour left going to start another party then?
Not yet, because we've got first past the post, Tony. As long as we've got first past the post, we've got to stay in the same party. It's the only way.
Without people like Ken Livingstone and Chris Williamson, though.
Well, indeed. Indeed, but ultimately at some point...
And possibly you, for example.
Well, no.
For some of your views.
No, I'm not leaving.
You may be expelled. Expelled.
Well, maybe so. That's up to those who want to think like that. Ultimately, there's going to be... The political system doesn't represent the underprivileged in this country. If they vote Labour, the Labour Party has got to be a safe for the relatively privileged, therefore they can't do anything for the underprivileged.
Okay.
In other countries, with proportional representation, just like the way Sinn Féin has now become the main opposition in Ireland, they are. And of course, the government is already wobbling there. Soon enough, they're going to take over, because the system allows that. It allows it in New Zealand too. You can kick for touch and you can switch the ball and all sorts of things. But under first past the post, just as we've seen in the United States of America, we're going to have brain dead Joe Biden or brain dead Donald Trump, because that's the only option.
Just as
you're
touching on the whole situation in the Republic of Ireland, that is, I think, quite fascinating. The way that it looks now likely, people have looked back on this latest Irish election and said, well, if the Sinn Féin had stood more candidates, they might actually now be running the country.
Yeah, I think that's a bit of ramping up by Sinn Féin. I mean, Sinn Féin certainly, if they'd stood more candidates, would have had a bigger vote. But the problem they've got is that the traditional parties are so hostile to working with them, even though the loyalist parties
are... That's like the Tweedledum, Tweedledee party. Yeah, it's a bit like the British and American. Yeah, you've got the two main parties are actually working in lockstep.
Yeah, but at the same time, because you've got PR, new voices can come through. We imposed proportional representation on Germany in the 1940s to make sure that people couldn't just bluff their way into power on a minority of the vote.
So do you think Sinn Féin will charge in the next election in Ireland?
They will obviously be hoping to win the next election in Ireland, for sure, yeah.
And I don't think the way that the main parties, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, have behaved is going to endear them to the voters
at
all.
Well, no, the problem for them is that they by forming a coalition, the Greens have also decided to join the coalition, of course. And, of course, they got wiped out because they were in coalition with Fianna Fáil, and then Fianna Fáil crashed the banks, as it was perceived, and the Greens got wiped out on the back of that.
And I'm suddenly reminded that we should really have asked Tim Kent in the first hour a bit about Ed Davey and what he makes of him, because he's just taken over as Lib Dem leader.
The problem for the Lib Dems is that nobody has heard that they're having a leadership election or has heard of Ed Davey, which is a bit unfortunate for them. So they're crying in the wilderness.
They are certainly in national politics still really suffering with a couple of things, with Jo Swinson and her attempt to completely reverse the Brexit vote without asking anybody. And the other thing, of course, is the whole gorgeous coalition relationship between Nick Clegg and David Cameron, which went down like a lead balloon. Anyway,
we've still got 11 MPs, which is a lot more than the Greens.
Well, it's just a kind of residual... Anyway, let's get on to talk about, or to hear from, in fact, Mohamed Rafiq, who died last week. He's an ex-Bank of England employee. And I spoke to him back in 2012, sitting in his Rolls Royce, actually, I think it was in Croydon. In fact, the engine ticks over so quietly in that car, you can hardly hear it in this interview. But he had some fascinating things to say as a former insider in the City of London.
it is not really possible to study central banking. The understanding that is taught in academia through economic circles has got very little to do with the practical reality on the ground. And that is simply because it's, you know, as the Americans would say, a bum steer. If people don't know what the actual subject is and the subject matter, they can talk till the cows come home about anything else. They can't fix anything because their core understanding is wrong. So even without the conspiracy theory element, which isn't a theory, it's a conspiracy fact, as I was describing the difference between the understandings there, and that's carefully managed because the people who understand what's going on pass that on an intergenerational basis, and it's a very limited need-to-know basis.
But it sounds almost like a cult.
Yeah, you could say it was almost like that. It was a money cult. I mean, these people had been earning from these processes for generations. In the same way somebody might be a rope maker or a candlestick maker or a smith of some description, these people passed on from one generation to the next so that their children got this instant leg in. The institutions that I worked for instance, were purely old Etonian. So if you didn't have the old school tie, and everybody knows this, this is not a theory, this is fact, historical fact. If you didn't have the school tie, you didn't get on the board. It was that simple. It was got nothing to do with capability or qualification. It was completely a privileged hierarchy.
Back in the 1970s and 80s, I mean, in the 80s, and when we started dropping off from the idea of full employment, at some point, Britain has gone from being a country where money actually serves the population and serviced the nation to a point where we're now feeling that actually we are serving the money system. At what point did that happen?
Well, I think it's always been like that. I think that after the Second World War, they lifted the yoke slightly. But if you go back Second World War, you don't have to go back that far to find children cleaning the inside of chimneys, etc. So there was a system of slavery in this country that, although we like to look at slavery systems in other parts of the world, slavery did exist here. We had child slave labour. There were unions that fought against that to try and get some kind of equality in life. We kind of take all of those fights for granted now that went on back then and think that this system, which is slowly, insidiously seeping its way into becoming the master of our lives, is something new. It's actually something returning, and hence the old mantra, those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. If we study the history of this system, we'll see very clearly that all that's happening is a repeat of what's happened previously. It's been digitized, it's sold in a different way, where it's marketed, and we're made to feel comfortable about it and made to feel that it's the right and proper thing, but actually it isn't. The whole thing needs challenging from the root up.
Well, that's a pretty good summary of what's happened. I'm reminded of the economist Kaletsky, because he was an economist who was quite prominent in what you might call the Keynesian era of full employment and nationalised industries and so on. And at that stage, and I went to university at the end of that sort of era, people were just saying, well, capitalism's reformed itself. It's not like it used to be back in the bad old days.
Oh, I think you've been a bit mean to him saying it's pretty good. I think it's better than you in some ways. No. He's talking there about from someone who's seen right at the very inside of the city of London. And he's talking about it as certainly this whole idea of Etonians, the intergenerational nature. This is like basically a money guild. Like the medieval guilds, that if you're born into it, then you know about it. And he's also saying there that our understanding, that economics, in fact, you say this quite a bit yourself, don't you? That actually it's the understanding and the teaching and the whole sort of university ethos around economics is completely wrong. And that's the way they like it, because they know what's really going on and you don't.
Yeah, well, coming back to what I was saying about the end of the Keynesian era, Kaletsky said, the problem is that they're never going to, basically you've got full employment, capitalism is working well in many respects, of course we were still having the Vietnam War and all the rest of it, but basically capitalism, you know, there were universal schooling, healthcare, all of these things, but of course it's only conditional, and the traditional ruling classes, the old Etonians, let's bring them into it, they were never going to accept that as a permanent setup. And that's what Thatcherism and Reaganism was all about, We're going to get rid of the last 30 years, what they call the 30 glorieux in France, the 30 glorious years, and we're back to the 19th century with the same kind of gaps between rich and poor, the same dominance of, in fact, there's more dominance of finance capital now than there was in that era. And we're now reaching a point where, you know, there is going to be an implosion as a result of the mismanagement of capitalism. Capitalism probably is going to collapse anyway because it's got all these tendencies towards
collapse.
Well,
it will be pushed at the right moment. Insiders will make most money out of it.
Well, that may be so, but it may just break down of its own internal contradictions. But also, you've got... we bailed the banks out in 2008 and we bailed them out again in 2019. And of course, that was only supposed to happen once. And if it happens twice...
You mean 2020?
No, 2019 is when they started bailing the banks out in September, before the pandemic in November.
But we had this massive bailout in March, didn't we?
But the bailouts began in September 2019, which is when COVID then came along as the perfect cover story for bailing the banks out. And this, of course, is if we'd bailed the banks out without having COVID as a cover story, everybody would have been going nuts. Keir Starmer, got a picture of him there on the computer. He would have been going nuts. Why are we bailing the banks out? But, of course, we all know why we're bailing the banks out.
That's if it's he was only if he was told to.
Well, don't judge Starmer too. We're going to see which way he's going to jump. He will be infinitely better than the incompetents who are currently running the country.
Well, I don't disagree with that, but I'm not convinced that Starmer is really his own person. He doesn't really seem to make his own decision. Well, that is, we're starting to get into philosophical stuff there. So perfect time to move into to talk about our final item with David Livingstone, which is about Kabbalism. But before we do that, finally, I'm going to be speaking, I believe, in Castle Park here in Bristol. A group called Stand Up X is organising a whole tour. In fact, they sent me an email earlier where they say there's 25 cities in Britain in 27 days over the next month or so. They're doing a kind of grand tour with a bunch of organisers in their cars going from city to city to city, organising something called Stand Up X. Now, their idea, Martin, I don't know whether you think this is a good idea or not, is they're getting many of the critics of the current government, particularly the policy around masks and lockdowns and this sort of thing, together in these various cities to do that. So I'll put a link up on our show page to Stand Up X, and I don't think it's entirely finalised, but they're doing a kind of tour around the country, 25 cities in 27 days over the next month or so.
Well, people are entitled to do anything they want to do politically. But whether everybody's going to agree with them is another matter, isn't it? But me or you or them.
Well, we shall see. I'll certainly be setting out my stall. I quite like the idea that, you know, there'll be people that I very much disagree with and other people that I will agree with, and I'll probably learn something in the process. So that's Castle Park, 2 o'clock on Sunday. The other thing to say about that, I suppose, is that even though all the local media were notified of this, there's been nothing on the local media about it, whereas with the Black Lives Matter march, we had adverts basically on the local press on the Thursday and the Friday that it was going to happen at the weekend. We're not getting that at all with Stand Up X. So I don't quite know if the media have already decided there are good demonstrations and bad demonstrations. I suppose that would be normal, Martin, wouldn't it?
It would, because the media are not honour-bound to be neutral. They can basically take any side they like, can't
Certainly
they?
Certainly they are nowadays, you're right. But anyway, so this is, we're going to hear now from David Livingstone. He's the author of Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea, which is, I think, an absolutely terrific book delving into the modern manifestation of fascism, which is an obsession with technology, the idea that humans can genetically engineer themselves to be amazing and great, and, for example, to eliminate death from the genetic codes, this kind of thing, to hook up with computers, to plug in your nervous system to a computer. But anyway, this book is more really about, or this discussion is more about one of his books called The Dying God. And this is about the history of the Kabbalah from the Magi to the Assassins with David Livingstone.
So different scholars emphasize different sources. So some emphasize the Persian influence, some emphasize the Greek, some emphasize the other. Some tried to claim it was native to Judaism. Some said it was foreign to Judaism. And there's only one way to answer it. And that's the verse 102 of Baqarah. in the Quran. And there it says that in Babylon, the Jews learned, if I can paraphrase it properly, they learned magic from the Satans. Mm-hmm. And the Satans practiced what was preached by Harut, the angels Harut and Marut in Babylon. And they learned magic from them. And so the Jews who practiced this apostatized. They knowingly turned, it's, the Quran says, they turned their backs on their religion. So why this is important is that it pinpoints the emergence of the Kabbalah in the 6th century BC when the Jews were held there in captivity. Mm-hmm. And that's an important point because first, as you know, Moses and his descendants went to Egypt. They stayed there for several hundred years. Joseph and his brothers went to Egypt. Their descendants were led by Moses out of Egypt. They went to Palestine. They conquered the land from the Canaanites. They were, according to the Bible, they were warned repeatedly to avoid the worship of their neighbors. Mm-hmm. And so the Canaanites practiced a cult called the cult of the dying and rising God.
Mm.
And this is a God that dies in winter and resurrects in spring, corresponding with Easter. And basically what I show in my book, The Dying God, is that it's a satanic cult, effectively. This is recognized by, it's not recognized directly by scholars, but scholars recognize it as what they call a chtonic cult, which is a cult of, the dying God was worshipped as a god of the underworld. So, which is why Satan today is associated with hell, and hell is associated with the underworld, because the dying god was worshipped as Pluto or Hades, which is the Greek form and version of the devil. So they used to practice basically satanic rituals in worship of this dying god, typically that involved human sacrifice of children, and this is why you find mentions in the Bible that the Jews used to sacrifice their children to Moloch. Moloch is a version of Baal, and so Moloch is the planet Saturn. So out of the seven, at the time there were seven known planets, and they make like a spectrum going from Jupiter to Saturn, and Jupiter represents am I getting that right? The sun to Saturn. So sun is gold and Saturn is lead. And Saturn is considered the opposite of the sun, is considered the nocturnal sun or the black sun. And so to Saturn, you perform evil sacrifices. So they used to have these rituals that used to involve intoxicants, sometimes, you know, different like psychoactive substances, dancing, demon possession, and human sacrifice. So the Bible, according to the Bible, God warns the Israelites repeatedly to avoid following to the cult of the dying god of the Canaanites. And they are warned several times that unless they desist, that they will be taken into captivity, and they'll be taken away, the temple will be destroyed. So this happens twice. So the first instance, the Assyrians are sent in. They conquer the northern kingdom of Israel, and they are taken into parts of Iran and in the land of the Medes, so Iran and beyond, and that's where they become lost. Mm. So that's where the 10 tribes become the lost tribes of Israel. Mm. The two remaining tribes of Judah and Benjamin remain in Judah, but they are conquered several decades later by the Babylonians. Babylonians take them into captivity to Babylon. They remain there for about 50 years. And it's then that the apostatizing Jews learn magic from the jinn. And so what's interesting, there's one scholar in particular who nailed it. His name is Frantz Cumont, who's a Belgian scholar. And I've said this many times, in my estimation, he's the greatest scholar of the 20th century. Like, the amount of knowledge a guy like this has is really, truly impressive. The problem is, like, a lot of modern scholars, and this is not my opinion, they're just expressed by a few leading scholars, they tend to focus on a particular path. And especially given the popularity of Greece, they'll focus on Greece or they'll focus on it. But the problem is because the modern perception is that these civilizations evolved independently, very few of them recognize that they need expert knowledge in several civilizations to be able to understand one or all of them. So right. To understand Greek civilization, you have to understand Persian culture, and you have to know it. You really got it. You can't just have a passing observation. You really have to understand it properly. Yeah, Persian culture in particular, and then Roman culture and Egyptian culture. So what Franz Kimmel pointed out is that after the 6th century BC, the world came to know about what were called magi. So they're in the Bible, the three magi that come to visit Jesus, right? So they're famous around the world. Dr.
Mersey, one of the brothers, I don't know if you know about Dr. Mersey, but one of the brothers I interview quite a lot, he talks about this, that the prophet, when he'd written his letter to Khosrow, he had specifically referenced the fact that if you don't accept Islam, you will be responsible for the sins of the Magi's.
Right.
Specifically referencing that, and the prophet himself referenced that. But anyway, please continue.
So it could be Zoroastrians they're referring to.
Yes.
But so the Magi became famous throughout the world. So the word magic comes from the Magi. Right, so they became famous throughout the world as sorcerers and magicians. And so the problem is that when scholars of Kabbalah look at the influence of the Persian religion or Zoroastrianism on Kabbalah, there's no relationship. And this is the part they don't get. So they're like, they dismiss. So they look at Zoroastrianism and say, no, it has no influence whatsoever on Kabbalah, except very remote. So what Franz Kimmel pointed out is that there's a lot of secondary evidence that describes the cult of the Magi. And when you look at it, it has no relationship whatsoever to Zoroastrianism, even though the Magi were supposedly priests of Zoroastrianism. Mm-hmm. So what he identifies, as well as another scholar, which is R.C. Zehner, they point out that the Magi were heretical Zoroastrians. Mm. In fact, R.C. Zehner points out that they were devil-worshipping or deva-worshipping, demon-worshipping devas, the demon-worshipping Magi or Zoroastrians.
Like the assassins in the Muslim world, in a sense.
The direct relationship to the assassins. So the Magi, I lost my point there. They were devil-worshipping
so you were talking about. Sorry, I don't want to interfere in this.
Is proof in the Greek works, especially the works of Heraclitus. There's also papyrus that was discovered a few decades ago that specifically describes the Magi as being devil worship or demon worshippers, and as basically in worshippers of the infernal. Mm. And so this Magi cult then spread to various parts of the world. And the point that I am making is that, in my book, The Dying God, is that this cult obviously is not Zoroastrian. It's not Persian. When you look at it, it's the exact same set of beliefs that became the core of Kabbalah.
Hmm.
So that is the worship of the planets, the identification of the four elements, the belief in reincarnation, so astrology, numerology, and also mixed with the worship of the dying god. So what's interesting basically is what seems to have happened is that these Jews who used to worship the dying god before they came to Babylon, when they got to Babylon, they mixed that cult with magic. That's how Kabbalah came about. So what you find now is that beyond the 6th century, the Magi, especially, the Persians conquer Babylon and they liberate the Jews, and the Jews get to go back to Palestine to rebuild the temple. But not all of them go back to Palestine. Some of them go to Greece. Some of them go to Egypt and specifically Alexandria. And that is where you find extensions of the Magian influence and where it develops. So that's why, so basically what happens is Plato and Pythagoras were influenced basically they developed ideas of the Magi. I argue that Plato was a Kabbalist. He is regarded as a Kabbalist by leading Kabbalists throughout the centuries. According to several ancient Jewish scholars, Plato derived his teachings from the Jews. He is claimed that he traveled to Egypt to learn. It's claimed that Pythagoras traveled to Persia to learn amongst the Magi. So it's not a far-fetched theory. It's been supported over and over by various sources throughout history. So what happens is that so this Magi cult develops in Greece as Greek philosophy, and it develops in Egypt as what's called Hermeticism. And Hermeticism is a cult of alchemy that is based on the worship of Egyptian dying god Hermes. And so out of Greek philosophy, you get Neoplatonism. And so now when the Jews become active in Palestine in the first century BC, all these influences now come back, and that's where you get the birth of Kabbalah.
So I bet they don't teach you that at Oxford at the PPE course, Martin, for politics, philosophy and economics, and the middle bit, philosophy particularly.
Well, that is a version of ancient history. And he's mentioned quite a lot of things there. He mentions Zoroastrianism. He mentions Babylonian exile of the Jews. He talks about Plato. He mentions Pythagoras. And he's got a particular axe he's trying to grind there, which sounds very familiar to me, which is the idea that there is this ancient wisdom, or possibly evil wisdom, which runs through all of these things. Now, in actual fact, I read a lot of not so much philosophy, but archaeology and history. And what he's doing there is he's basically stringing together lots of different things and drawing his conclusion from the things that he's strung together. But there's lots of other people who've got different views from that about the relationship between the things that he's talking about.
But isn't it a little bit like the City of London, that the people that really know what's going on, they're going to make sure that the universities and everyone else is not going to find it out?
Well, you've got the idea that there's some kind of esoteric knowledge and a small group of people who have that esoteric knowledge and everybody else who hasn't got it. That is there's quite a strong streak of esotericism in history. I mean, people believing themselves to have the knowledge that others haven't got. It's quite common. In fact, you know, and you could even see it in modern communism. You know, we are the elite that understand the laws of history, and the masses are going to be moved by our superior knowledge. What I'd say about all of these things is, yes, there are elites that try and control things. They do create kind of elite ideologies that they want, you know, in order to fulfill whatever goals they've got. But history carries on being messy. And all sorts of messy stuff happens, and it's very difficult to predict what's going to happen next.
I can't help but just raise the interesting spectre of the interview we did a few months ago with Philip Beale and his thing about the Phoenicians, because, you know, there you've got the possibility that they're involved in this spreading this kind of similar ideas about mathematics, geometry and that sort of thing around the world in ancient history. But what about this? I mean, what he's trying to do, I think, David Livingston, maybe he's failing, maybe he's succeeding, I quite like his attempt anyway, is to come up with a kind of unified theory of occultism and mysticism, where you've got the occult, which is this kind of secret societies and machinations behind the scenes, which are actually changing things, making things happen in a way a bit like a James Bond film, you know, trying to change the course of history through the secret services or whatever. And then against that, you've got mysticism, which is the kind of myth making, pushing stuff out, information operations, pushing stories out, myths out through the mainstream press, a bit things like 9/11, things like, if you're going back even further, Prester John, the letter of Prester John, which was a way of trying to get everyone behind the Crusades, getting all these wealthy people to put all their money into the Crusades, thinking it was a great Christian thing to do. So do you think he's actually getting anywhere when he's trying to put this unified theory together?
I think the problem with all unified theories is that they're unified. And in actual fact, for example, we're only talking here about the Middle East. We could be talking about Southeast Asia, which has got a completely different mythological basis. And they've got esoteric beliefs in Southeast Asia, but they're not the same as esoteric beliefs in the Eastern Mediterranean.
Well, I'm sure he would say that there are indications of these philosophies in Hinduism, for example.
All right, well, some people claim, and it's not necessarily illogical, that all human beliefs are linked because there's a fundamental reality in which links all human beings together. That's an interesting idea, but the reality of life in general is that it's messy, and that what you usually find is you've got competing stories about what's happening, competing ideologies, competing ways of looking at the world, not just one, and in actual fact they're all struggling with each other to push their particular version of events and of the way reality is constructed.
Anyway, David Livingstone's book is called The Dying God. Maybe I should email him, Martin, and see if he'll send you a copy, and maybe you'll even read the first few pages of it. What do you think?
Well, I can look it up online if I was that interested. I read an awful lot about these things, but I tend to read the academic works rather than people who've got
Don't you think truth is more around the fringes rather than at the heartlands of the universities?
No, I think that the people who do modern historical research, it's far superior to what was written even 10 or 15 years ago.
The universities,
for example, we've now got access to DNA analysis, which really tells us who is related to who.
Yes,
and there's been lots of speculation about that. We now know
a tremendous amount of faking of DNA too.
Well, what you want, Tony, is you want everybody...
I'm saying, for example, the Martin Bormann skull, we've talked about quite a lot of times. They said, oh, yes, this is definitely his skull, and maybe it was his skull. But they were making all sorts of claims that they could, but weren't necessarily justified. And these sorts of technologies are also open to abuse. They're a belief system. It's a little bit like he was talking there about these ancient civilizations. It's what you believe that counts, not what the facts are.
Well, indeed, and that's exactly the point. I mean, ultimately, it should be the facts that determines what we believe. But in actual fact, most people pick their facts to suit their original intentions.
And maybe that's just what you're doing, and maybe that's just what I'm doing.
Well, indeed.
Who knows? Anyway, time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Lib Dem councillor for Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent. Also to our Irish Republican Labour activist, Martin Summers, you just heard from, and to studio engineer, Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. I'm at Castle Park, 2 o'clock, here in Bristol on Sunday. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Sunday evenings at 6. Danny Lopsch on BCFM is excellent. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday, where we'll be joined by 9/11 author Ian Henshaw to discuss similarities between the COVID op and 9/11. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.